It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster
conquered the street.
You like fighting a woman?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
Come over here and fight me.
It's not hot.
You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
If you enjoyed the Boneyard match at WrestleMania, boy, does WWE have a deal for you. Talked about this on Wednesday on the Dynamite stream. Now you can pre-order your very own WrestleMania 36 Undertaker Boneyard Edition plaque to commemorate the match between The Undertaker and AJ Styles. It is limited edition, so only 536 of them have been made. Why 536? Beats me. But there's only 536 of these things. It includes a few still frames from the match, a few shots of The Undertaker, AJ's hand coming up from the grave, and a capsule of dirt from the match itself, or so they claim. $75 for a capsule of dirt. And you know what? They'll probably sell them out, too. But I said this on Wednesday. At least include, like, a signed photo. You would think, like, the picture of The Undertaker that's on there would have his signature. There's only 500 of these things. Sit him down at the PC, give him a stack of pictures, have him sign them. Although I guess this would have been after WrestleMania. Maybe he's not in Florida. He's probably back in Texas. But would it really have been that hard to have the damn thing autographed? You're spending $75 for a capsule of dirt. I mean, the least they could do is give you a John Hancock there on the picture. Yeah, but when I mentioned this on Twitter last week, a lot of you tweeted me comparing this to Gamer Girl's bathwater. And I had no idea what you were talking about. So you made me go and look. And now I wish I hadn't. Then again, Britney Spears' used chewing gum, once sold on eBay for $14,000. So the message that I take away from this whole thing, basically, is that we are a failed species. This is the 650th episode of the Solid Monster Sounds Off. Only took me 12 and a half years to get here. For Sunday, May 3rd, 2020, I am the Solid Monster. You can now order the new Eighth Wonder of the World, the True Story of Andre the Giant book. I got my review copy. I've only just started reading it. There is said to be a lot of cool little details and stories in there that have never been shared before. The complete look at Andre the Man and the Performer right on down to the final days of his life. Visit audibletrial.com/solidmonsters. Get your free copy with a 30-day trial of their service. But I noticed something else this week that I was not aware of. You're going to love this. All you Bella Army members out there, I know you're out there. I know who you are. You may not raise your hand. You may be a member in secret. But all you Bella Army members out there, Nikki and Brie Bella have a new book coming out this Tuesday on Audible called Incomparable. You may want to use your link to get the Bella book for free. I mean, how can you not with a description like this? A raw, honest, and revealing co-memoir by twin sisters, WWE Hall of Fame inductees. I completely forgot they're in the Hall of Fame. There was no Hall of Fame ceremony, but I guess technically everybody who was going into the Hall of Fame this year, Batista, JBL, Jushin Thunder Liger, technically I guess they're all WWE Hall of Famers. Anyway, WWE Hall of Fame inductees and stars of the hit E! Shows Total Bellas and Total Divas. As twins, the Bellas have always competed. Legend has it that Nikki dropkicked Brie in the womb so that she could make her grand entrance first. Guess my question is, was that before or after she told Brie that she wished she had died in the womb? Just asking for a friend. But anyway, it continues. The rest of the world, though, often treated them as identical. Even interchangeable, so they decided to do something about it. After they made it into the WWE, the Bellas accomplished so much together, bringing in young girls and women while building the Bella Army, helping the transition of female performers from divas to superstars, starring in Total Divas and Total Bellas, and founding companies like Birdie B, Nicole and Brizzy Beauty, and Bonita Bonita Wine. Though their early journey began with loss, abuse, and plenty of rough times, these challenges shined the diamond. I don't think I've ever heard that expression before. Shined the diamond. They resolved to be survivors and the heroes of their own stories and to take control and responsibility for their lives. Eventually, they would come to show girls everywhere that they can do anything. The Bellas may be identical twins, but as individuals, they have proven themselves incomparable. I feel so inspired after reading that. It makes me want to dropkick my sister in the womb. I don't even have a sister that I'm aware of. I mean, you know, Papa Monster was on the road a lot driving that truck. I suppose one can never be sure. We could have a big Dick Dudley scenario here with lots of little Sala Monsters all around the country. They could be listening to this right now. But if you want the Bella book, use my link. I think I deserve a little something from Brie after my experience in that MRI machine. I deserve something for my pain and suffering. So go ahead and use my link. If you want to become a PayPal VIP, of course you know the drill. You can always do so on thesalamonster.com. You'll see that PayPal button smiling right back at you on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out here on the show. You guys killed it this week. I got a bunch of first-time donators to the show, too. And in the spirit of all these empty arena shows, I thought it would be appropriate to do what I call empty arena shout-outs this week for all of our PayPal producers. So let's see if this works here. Here we go. This thing on? Here we go. The Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Deadpool James Herrera, John Loose Cannon Lopez, the Florida Freebird Brian Becerra, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Downtown Kenny Brown, Masgrave Micah Harshaw, Killshot Keith Hart, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, Josh the Shooter Stockton, Stephen Handyman Halistic, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Maniac Moderator Jeff Lippman, Raymond the Mountie Medina, Radiant Ray Wrighton, hope RJ's doing well, Dark Soul Jeff Cole, Project Zero Mortals Wayne Ashanti, congrats to he and the missus, who are celebrating their first anniversary as a married couple. I hope that you guys are not sick of each other under a quarantine, wherever you may be. The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep. Canadian Destroyer, Rob Morrow. The Lake George Lunatic, Bobby Blanchard. Glory Hound, Gareth Moore. DeVenom, John Iru. Mean Matt Forbush. First Class, LT Gilberry. No Mercy, Nick Horacek. Raj Must-See Makwana. Magnificent Mark Winsley, one of our first-time donators this week. Degagne Pierre, thank you for the support. OJ the Juice Wicker. That's a killer name. I know OJ just started listening to this podcast because his nephew Miles told me, so hello to OJ. Belt fan Brent Banner, who has a brand new video premiering today on his YouTube channel at youtube.com/surreal469, where he and his best friend, former indie wrestler Kyle Webb, list their favorite wrestling title belts. You guys know my favorite wrestling title belt, right? Winged Eagle. I got a fondness for Big Gold. I got a fondness for the classic IC title. Those might be my top three. Those probably would be my top three. Dominic Neek Pittman, who wants to give a shout out to fellow Sala Monster Facebook group member Jason Clark on the 100th episode of his podcast, The Bottom Line Wrestling Podcast, which has been on the air since 2017. So that's over 2 years of podcasting mayhem from Jason Clark. And Dominic says that Jason may never become a mod of the Facebook group, but here's to 100 more episodes. Well, look, never say never. Never say never. Even Taryn Terrell was once the general manager of ECW, so you gotta stay optimistic. You can find the Bottom Line Wrestling Podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. All right, let me exit my empty arena realm here. Now you know why those empty arena shows suck. They sound terrible, too. I want to shout out Rob Siebert from PrimaryIgnition.com, Chrissy Carr, and Ashley Zarzar. Thank you for the reviews on iTunes. Some very nice things they had to say about the podcast. Thank you for the 5 stars. I appreciate it. And finally, I got a nice message from the executive director of the Humane Society of Central Texas. They named a dog after me. How cool is that? They even tweeted me a picture of the pup, and they are looking to get him adopted, so show them some love, not just for that dog. You can find the tweet on my page, but all the dogs that they have looking for new homes. If you live in Texas, they are located at the Waco Animal Shelter at 2032 Circle Road in Waco, Texas, or visit humanesociety-centraltexas.org. So humanesociety-centraltexas.org for more information. Let me knock this out first on this rumor started by one Dutch Mantel on his Twitter account last week that he heard from a source in Stamford, Connecticut, that a deal is being negotiated for WWE to sell the company and to sell the WWE Network to ESPN and Fox. And that it could happen as early as this month. He framed this as big news, huge news, as if he were breaking some kind of big news story. The reality is, I'm not taking this seriously at all, because it doesn't appear that there's any real smoke to the fire here. Now, I think Vince McMahon is open to the idea, and I think he's even said this before, that he's open to the idea of selling. They're always listening to offers. They would be stupid not to. And I believe Vince McMahon is open to the idea of one day selling if he thinks that the offer is right. But he can't even sell his pay-per-views off the network to a streaming service, which he said, now this is before the pandemic really hit, on one of the last conference calls, he thought that was a deal that would be all wrapped up before WrestleMania. And not only did they not reach a deal with an Amazon or a Netflix or a Hulu or a Peacock or any of these streaming services, any deal sounds like it's dead, or at least on pause for the time being. And you honestly believe that ESPN or Fox is going to spend, what would they have to spend for to make it worth Vince McMahon's while, huh? I know when the stock was down last week or the week before, the market cap or whatever, the valuation of the company was down to like $2 billion, $3 billion. It had been as high as over $7 billion. What do you think it would take to get Vince McMahon to sell WWE? $4, $5, $6 billion? To buy WWE? You really think ESPN and or Fox is going to spend $5, $6, $7 billion to buy WWE in the middle of a pandemic when everybody is losing money, everybody is cutting costs, everybody is slashing their workforce or you know, some more than others? There's no way. There is no way. I don't buy it. Apparently Dutch doesn't buy it either. Because his very next reply to somebody on Twitter was admitting that he finds it all very doubtful. So he puts it out there, and of course people ran with it as news, and then like a few seconds later, they don't mention this, but he's tweeting people saying, yeah, I know, it's kind of doubtful. That would be like me going on Twitter. I mean, I know Dutch Mantel is, you know, he probably does keep in touch with people in Stamford, and he has been in the wrestling business, I get that. But he's not in WWE right now. I don't know who he got this information from, but it's like somebody just going on Twitter and saying, oh, I heard that WWE is looking to sell. I heard that, you know, I heard through the grapevine that they're going to sell to Disney, you know, or they're going to sell to Papa John, who knows, whatever. I don't think there's anything to this at all. Now, would ESPN and Fox be buying it together? I'm not even sure what he means by that. ESPN and Fox going to buy WWE together or buying pieces of the company at the same time? ESPN takes the network, Fox takes the company. I mean, it's ridiculous to even think about. This report does not even make sense. Could WWE one day be sold? Yes. Is it being sold this month? Is it going to be sold even this year? No. And it's the sort of thing as a publicly traded company that would not happen in the dark of night. This would not kind of come up from behind people and sneak up on them. This is the kind of deal that you would hear about. There would be rumors about it. There would be news about it. There would be talk about it from more than just Dutch Mantel's Twitter. So believe me, if there were to ever be smoke to a story like this, you will be hearing it from more than just Zeb Coulter. So that's really all I have to say about that story. This week brought us news of three more WWE cuts. First, former UFC champion Cain Velasquez, who only a few short months ago signed what was said to be a very lucrative three-year deal. He had told ESPN in an interview that he has signed a three-year contract with WWE, ended up having all of two matches with the company, one of which wasn't even televised. He was released by WWE this past week. Actually, he was released a few weeks ago. We just only heard about it now. So, begs the question, who had the better run? I even said this on Twitter. I posed this question. Who had the better run, Cain Velasquez or Rob Gronkowski, who is now headed back to the NFL? He is still the 24/7 champion. Gronk is still the 24/7 champion. If the title didn't get passed around more than herpes, I would say that maybe it means something, but let's be honest, it really doesn't. My vote, and I said my vote goes to Kevin Federline. I got to go with K-Fed on this. I think K-Fed had a better run than either one of those guys. This guy has a win over John Cena, an unavenged win over John Cena. He remains undefeated. You can't beat that. So Kofi Kingston, he was sacrificed. His six-month reign as WWE champion was sacrificed for Cain Velasquez on that first SmackDown on Fox. You know, he was humiliated in 8 seconds. He lost the championship so that Cain could come on out. He could tackle Brock Lesnar. He could challenge Brock Lesnar. And he then proceeded to lose to Brock Lesnar in 2 minutes at Sweet Saudi Money a few weeks later. After which, we never saw him again. He did tag with Humberto Carrillo. Remember him? We were seeing him on TV every week. Now we don't see him at all. I mean, maybe he's, wherever he is, maybe he's stranded. He can't come to the tapings. Maybe that's it. But boy, they were giving him the big push. And now it's like, again, just vanished into thin air. But he did a tag team match. He tagged up with Humberto. And they beat Gallows and Anderson at a live event in Mexico City. And that was the last time that he stepped into a ring. Now, I remember when there was talk about him coming into wrestling. He's been a big wrestling fan his whole life. You know, he respects the wrestling business. Legitimate athlete, scary dude, you know, has wins over some big dudes. I mean, he's a big, tough guy. But I remember hearing about him wanting to wrestle, coming into wrestling, and having his debut match in AAA, which I believe was last summer. And he showed a lot of promise. You know, I actually watched part of that tag match that he was part of. He was out there wearing a lucha mask. He was doing lucha moves. Looked very smooth for a guy that's never done this before. That's what he wanted to do, apparently, in WWE. But they didn't want that version of Cain Velasquez. They wanted UFC Cain Velasquez. They didn't want Mil Máscaras. But they weren't using him in recent months. They're paying him all this money, and so they released him. I can't wait for the Hall of Fame induction video to see how they stretch that thing out. The more surprising cut for me was Gerald Briscoe, who was furloughed. He was not released. He might be brought back. But if he's not, he tweeted that it's been a heck of a run. Because there's no guarantee that all these people are going to be brought back. All the producers they let go that were furloughed and not fired. I know there's talk that perhaps they can bring some or all of these people back as early as July. There's no guarantee. If you've been furloughed, you might be brought back. You might not be brought back. So Briscoe said, if I'm not brought back, it's been a heck of a run. And it has been. He'd been with the company since 1984. This and the Mike Chioda release are the ones that shocked me the most. Briscoe had been an agent with them for many years. Obviously, he did the Stooges. I mean, this is long after he retired, obviously. He became a backstage agent. Obviously, he did the Stooges stuff with Pat Patterson back during the Attitude Era, which was very entertaining. He did have a brief stint with the 24/7 title, last summer at the Raw reunion show. Then he lost it that same night. See, I would consider him technically a three-time 24/7 champion. If you count the two hardcore title runs that he had from 20 years ago, he won the hardcore title not once, but twice. And back then, the 24/7 title in the Crash Holly era had that 24/7 rule, the hardcore title anyway, had a 24/7 rule in place. So would he not technically be a three-time 24/7 champion? I would argue that he is. I would just lump the two together. But a little over a decade ago, he suffered three strokes, I think all within the span of a few days of each other. I'm not even sure he realized that he had suffered three strokes, but he suffered three strokes. I think he had a fourth one a couple years after that. So he pretty much left that position that he had been in previously, transitioned to being a talent scout for the company, looking at football players, looking at amateur wrestlers. I don't have the list in front of me of names that he's recruited, but I would think that a lot of the names we see in WWE or have seen over the years, he has probably had a hand, he and Jim Ross both, in recruiting. So he's played a very valuable, very prominent role in the company for a very long time, and perhaps this is the end of the line for him. Perhaps this is the end of the line for Gerald Briscoe. That was a cut that I did not see coming. And then this week, Curtis Axel, Joe Hennig, was released, the son of Mr. Perfect Kurt Hennig. Back when, remember, he was Michael McGillicuddy coming out of those NXT seasons, he went nowhere. He was going nowhere with that name. He was going nowhere fast. Then he got the Curtis Axel name change, which was sort of a combination of his father's name and his grandfather's name, Larry the Axe. And he got Paul Heyman as his manager. And he won the Intercontinental Championship in 2013, which was cool because at that point, the IC title was still rocking the white strap and the classic design. The classic design that his father had held many years earlier. Not that ugly egg belt that they had for so long. And so to see him, just the visual of him wearing basically the same championship that his dad held is pretty cool. That was a pretty cool thing. And that, I guess unfortunately for him, turned out to be the peak of his career success. The same title in the IC title that I probably associate most with his father to this very day. When I think of that Intercontinental Championship, I probably associate it the most. Really, it's three guys. Actually, you know what? I'd say even four. Mr. Perfect, Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, and Razor Ramon. Those are probably the guys I associate the most with that IC title design. So anyway, that little push that he was getting, that fizzled out. Although it did give us that great nipple confetti gif. I know you know what I'm talking about. You go look up nipple confetti and you'll see what I'm talking about. That might have been Curtis Axel's greatest contribution in WWE. Could they have done more with him? Yeah, this is a common question that this is a common statement people make whenever anybody is released. Zack Ryder is released. Oh, they could have done more with him. Kurt Hawkins is released. Oh, they could have done more with him. EC3 is released. They could have done more with him. You bet your ass they could have done more with him. Curtis Axel is an interesting one. Could they have done more with him? Sure, they could have. They could have not cut the IC title run short, let that play out a little bit more, see where it took him. So, yeah, technically, of course, you could say that about almost anybody on the roster. They could do more with most of the talent that they have. That doesn't mean, though, that if they do, that talent is going to get over and become a big star, or that they're going to become some great success. And that, to me, is the bigger question. Would Curtis Axel, you know, could he have gone on to greater lasting success? Or was he really ever only destined to be at the level that he was at? You know, not everybody is going to get over the way that the company wants them to. Sometimes it ain't their fault. There was a charisma there that his father had that I think they tried to replicate with him, and the reality is it just wasn't there. But then came the Rybacksel stuff. He and Ryback as a tag team. Ryback got hurt. That came to an end. The Royal Rumble match in 2015, where he was attacked before entering. He was never officially eliminated because he was never officially entered. But that was how the whole Axelmania thing was born. I was never eliminated. I should go on to WrestleMania 31 and challenge for the world championship. And that kind of got him over in like a Rusev Day kind of way, you know. Got him a little bit of fan support there. Still to this day, never eliminated from that Royal Rumble match. There was the Miztourage, there was the B-Team with Bo Dallas. If I'm Bo Dallas, maybe I'm keeping my phone off. I'm just saying. But the reality is he wasn't climbing any higher than that. You know, when you have been slotted low down on the card in a comedy spot like he was for so many years, year after year after year, the big Curtis Axel push, it just wasn't coming. Now, maybe he was happy in the position that he was in. He wasn't really on television now at all. You know, the B-Team stuff had pretty much played itself out. Was he happy just kind of being part of WWE and collecting a paycheck and just being part of the family? Or is he going to be one of those guys, you know, we're seeing these videos that EC3 is putting out. Heath Slater has talked about now having this renewed fire and passion that was lacking in his final years in WWE. Are we going to see something like that from Axel? Axel, I think, is 40 years old. How much gas does he have left in the tank? You know, are we going to see a big Curtis Axel push on the independent scene if the independent scene ever recovers? Right now, there is no independent scene, which is what makes it tough for guys like Curtis Axel and Curt Hawkins and people like that. I don't know. I don't know that I really see some kind of big Curtis Axel resurgence. Maybe he'll prove a lot of people wrong. But to be honest, you know, he's a name that I would have expected them to, you know, when they're looking to trim the fat on people they're not using, the first people you look to are the people that you're not seeing on TV. He's one of those names I would have expected them to cut if they're looking to get rid of people. And that's exactly what they did. Did they cut the IC title run too short? Could they have tried harder with him? Yeah, but I don't know that things were going to wind up much better for him. Now, this week also brought the news from Florida. Back to Florida. I should have some weekly Florida update. This week's Florida Man update is sponsored by Manscaped. No, I'm kidding. This week brought news from Florida that a lot of people who don't know how to read took out of context. Boy, there's a lot of people out there who just don't know how to read. It's kind of scary. That's why audiobooks are so perfect. On some websites, though, and to be fair to the people who even can't read, some of these websites did them no favors, because you had some of these less reputable websites that just took something that was not exactly fully accurate, and they ran with it, and they ran with certain headlines that were very misleading. I saw headlines suggesting that the state of Florida would be allowing some fans back into sporting events, possibly as early as this week. That is not true. That is not happening. Not for WWE, it's not. The governor of Florida did issue an executive order that takes effect tomorrow. That executive order has nothing to do with any of this. That executive order said nothing of sporting events. It said nothing of wrestling events. The confusion stems from the fact that his Reopen Florida Task Force, that's the name of it, it's called the Reopen Florida Task Force, made a suggestion. They made a recommendation that in the state of Florida, large spectator sporting events should use strict social distancing guidelines and limit occupancy of venues to 25% of building capacity. So that was a task force recommendation. That was not anything that the governor announced. Now, he could wind up allowing it in the future based upon that recommendation, but he has not yet done so. I don't think we see 25% occupancy at WWE shows or AEW shows until the summer. I think they're itching to get people back into those buildings. I think it is going to end up happening. But this month seems very unlikely. Nor does it seem wise. You know, each state is going to make its own decision on when and how to start reopening. I saw the governor of Mississippi was slowly reopening the state. He was one of these governors that said, we got to start reopening. And they started the process of reopening certain businesses. And now he's pulling back. He's having second thoughts because they just had their largest spike in new cases. It certainly doesn't seem like we're on the back end of this thing yet. You got to be cautious. Exercise caution. You know, you can say that there are certain businesses and things people got to get back to work and different industries and such. But think of things in terms of allowing people into sporting events on the scale or hierarchy of what's most important here right now. I would not put that near the top of the list. Could I see a scenario in the state of Florida? Could I see a scenario where we see fans in the performance center, or they see fans being allowed back into full sail? Maybe sometime this summer. July, August. Yeah, I could see that. I'm not saying whether it's wise or not. I'm just saying, yeah, I could see that. I could see them pushing to have that happen. I could see WWE looking to SummerSlam as a big goal. You know, SummerSlam's like a good target. We're going to try to be back, try to get some people into the building for us. A big SummerSlam show in August. Whether that's in Boston or whether they move it out of Boston to Florida or some other state, I could see SummerSlam being a real goal that WWE is looking at and saying, okay, by August, by that SummerSlam show, we would like to have people, even if only 25% capacity, back into the building. Sounds very ambitious to me, but I could see that being a goal of theirs. Ring of Honor canceled all of its live events for the month of June, including their Best in the World pay-per-view in Baltimore on June 19th. They put out a press release that said, maintaining the commitment to making the health and safety of our fans and personnel the top priority during the crisis, Ring of Honor has canceled all live events that had been scheduled for June. They had an event scheduled in Dallas on June 5th and San Antonio on June 6th. Those are canceled as well. So Ring of Honor will not be doing shows anytime soon. I know the NWA had, I believe, made a statement, or maybe not made a statement, but there was the belief that the NWA might be looking to resume shows in June. I don't know where things stand on that front, because things have been quiet. Now they're starting to release some of the unreleased footage. You know, their Superpower show is going to be coming this month. They've had that in the can for a while. We saw Camille's debut in the ring, and her first words, like a newborn baby. We got to hear Camille speak for the first time on NWA last week. They put that up on their YouTube channel. So they have some stuff already shot. They have some stuff in the can from previously that they can run. When the next time is that we're going to see people in the studio for an NWA power show, no idea. No idea. But that is, you know, they do film in the state of Georgia, and Georgia has begun the process of reopening. So who knows? You know, there could potentially be NWA shows sooner than we see people back in a WWE show or an AEW show. And The Undertaker documentary series, Undertaker, The Last Ride. Remember they ran that trailer at WrestleMania? Everybody was getting all excited. Looks like a fantastic series. I can't wait to watch it. Now we have a premiere date for episode 1 on the WWE Network. It will drop next Sunday, May 10th, after the Money in the Bank pay-per-view. But I know you guys are going to watch me live on YouTube and then watch this on demand, right? Right? You better not pick Undertaker over me. Undertaker will be there waiting for you when you're done listening to me. You got to join me on YouTube. We got to talk about this Money in the Bank pay-per-view, starting from the ground level, going up to the roof. Anyway, the first episode is titled Chapter 1, The Greatest Fear. This is the description. Get a rare and revealing look at Mark Calloway, the man behind The Undertaker, as he prepares for the final match of his storied WWE career against Roman Reigns at WrestleMania 33. Final match, you say? Apparently The Undertaker thought it was his final match too, just like the rest of us did. Vince McMahon had other ideas. So anyway, that debuts next Sunday. I'm looking forward to watching that after I go live on YouTube for my Money in the Bank recap. Some raw thoughts from last Monday's show. This week we had 1,989 votes in the poll. So 10 votes less than last week. At least you didn't leave me hanging with one vote short of 2,000. So I thank you for that. 32% thumbs up. 68% of you gave this show a thumbs down. One thing I cannot give a thumbs down to is the fact that Samoa Joe is back at the announce desk with Tom Phillips and Byron Saxton. He replaced Jerry the King Lawler, who was used only as a host for a contract signing at the end of the show. This is a welcome improvement. We had a 25-minute six-man tag team match with Rey Mysterio, Aleister Black, and Apollo Crews beating Andrade, Angel Garza, and Austin Theory. And what I have come to realize at least with these WWE shows, is that 20-plus minute matches really don't work in an empty arena setting. I'm not talking Rockin' Mankind when they had their empty arena match in 99, or Lawler and Funk, you know, back in 81. Long matches in the PC, like 20 minutes or more, 25 minutes, they don't work. They don't work. Apollo pinned Andrade in the tag team match. He got the win. Apollo is, after all, in the Money in the Bank match, or he was. Backstage, he is talking to, was it Charlie? I think it was Charlie. He was talking to Chuck, and he made it very clear that he wanted a United States Championship match. He pinned Andrade in the match. Andrade showed up. He told him, "You don't deserve one." And Apollo Crews, when I say that he slapped Andrade, he slapped that boy so hard, Charlotte's grandkids are going to be black and blue.
"You don't deserve this opportunity.
How about now?"
That was a damn good slap. Shawn Michaels slapped Randy Orton once. That was on that. This one here was on that level. But neither one can top the greatest slap of all time. Stephanie McMahon, Slappy McSlapperson herself, slapping the soul out of Chris Benoit backstage on Raw. That is still the most wicked slap that I have ever heard. I don't know if it was the echo of the empty hallway they were standing in or what, but that is still my number one here 20 years later. So after that 20-minute opener, and we get the slap backstage, later on in the show, these two go out, and they have a 16-minute match for the United States Championship. And a good match. It's a good match. A lot of near falls here towards the end, going back and forth. It could have gone either way. I thought they were going to do the title change. They had me thinking that they were going to do a title change until Apollo missed a splash off the top rope and grabbed his knee in pain, and the referee waved the match off. Apollo Crews could not continue, and so Andrade retains by ref stoppage. Now, they played this up like it was a real injury. Clearly, it was not. Later on, they showed Apollo walking out of the trainer's room on crutches. He couldn't even speak. He was on the verge of tears. Later, they announced that Apollo Crews is officially out of the Money in the Bank ladder match. His replacement will be determined tomorrow night in a last chance gauntlet match. They love doing these gauntlet matches, and you know why? Because it's an easy way to kill an hour on the show. This gauntlet is going to go an hour. If it doesn't go an hour, it's going to go 45 minutes. On a 3-hour show, I'm not even saying it's a terrible way of killing time. But these long matches, this will be the first gauntlet that we see in an empty performance center. That just does not sound like fun. So they're going to do a gauntlet tomorrow night. When I heard that they announced the gauntlet, I just looked at this and I said, well, I mean, Apollo Crews is probably going to show up to Raw next week. He's going to, you know, he's not medically cleared. He finds a way to talk his way into the gauntlet, into a spot in the gauntlet. Even though if he can wrestle, if they clear him and he's able to wrestle, then it makes no sense to have a gauntlet to see who replaces him. It's his spot. That would be pretty stupid. But this is where this is WWE, right? Things rarely make sense anyway. So, I mean, when has that ever stopped him? They may be trying to build sympathy for him. I don't think this Apollo Crews little mini push is done here. I think this was designed for a reason, and it could just be that they're looking to build sympathy for him and they want him to run the gauntlet and really earn his own spot back. Again, that really sounds stupid when I say that out loud, but you know, that's the first thought that crossed my mind. Then I was thinking about this and I'm looking at the lineup for the match. I'm looking at who they have in this Men's Money in the Bank match. And as I look at the lineup, we've got Rey Mysterio, we've got Aleister Black, Daniel Bryan, King Corbin, and Otis, who qualified on Friday night. This match is stacked with babyfaces. All but Corbin are babyfaces. So maybe what they did is somebody looked at this and said, you know, we're a little light on the heel side. Apollo Crews, he was the most replaceable of the bunch. We're not going to remove Aleister Black. We're not going to remove Rey Mysterio. So let's do a storyline scenario where Apollo gets hurt right? That way you didn't get sympathy for him. That explains why he can't go. And we'll replace him with a heel. And then lo and behold, I see yesterday a report. I think John Pollock broke the news on Post Wrestling. We get a report that AJ Styles, yes, he is not dead. AJ Styles is slated to return to Monday Night Raw this week for the first time since he was literally buried at WrestleMania 36. He is back from the dead. And just in time for this last chance gauntlet match. My early prediction from a month ago, which I think I actually threw out my Money in the Bank choices for the winners on the WrestleMania recap, which was exactly 1 month ago. My early pick for the men's Money in the Bank was AJ Styles. My pick might yet come true. But first, he would have to enter himself into the gauntlet. And then he would have to go on to win the entire thing. He was part of a gauntlet in Saudi Arabia only a few months ago. He would have won that had it not been for The Undertaker coming and taking his trophy away from him. So maybe, you know, this is AJ now coming back and maybe he'll get the win in the gauntlet. He's a heel. They at least get a second heel inserted into the Money in the Bank match. So I would keep an eye on that. I would keep an eye on that scenario playing out on Raw tomorrow night. Styles and Sasha Banks. Sasha Banks was my other early pick until they screwed up the women's Money in the Bank by having Lacey beat Sasha to qualify, which I still maintain was a very dumb thing for them to do. They booked a triple threat match on this show last Monday with Nia Jax, Asuka, and Shayna Baszler, three of the women in the Money in the Bank. There is literally no reason to book this match on this show last week with these three women. No reason. There is no good winner that could come out of this. Unless you have a situation where Baszler and Asuka, they basically just murder each other. You know, in a triple threat, though, there's no DQ. So it's not like they can go brawl somewhere and get counted out and Nia Jax win. There's no good scenario to just throw this match out there on TV. Unless this is the match at the pay-per-view, which it's not. Technically, it's not a triple threat. I don't know why they would have even booked this match in the first place. Especially, look, it's three heels. I like Asuka, but it's three heels. I'm not even sure, you know, what they thought this accomplished. Did it really make Nia Jax look all that tough? Having seen the segment, I'm not sure why the match was made. It ended in 2 minutes. There was no winner. Asuka took out Shayna. Nia took out Asuka. And then they just played her music. This was very dumb. Liv Morgan, she beat Ruby Riott. Another loss for Ruby Riott. But another win for Liv Morgan. See, it's like the glass half full, glass half empty analogy. It depends how you look at it. It's another loss for Ruby Riott. True. But it's another win for Liv Morgan. They have, you know, they've picked Liv Morgan and said, we're going to build her up. We're going to give her some wins. We're going to give her some credibility on TV. That's a good thing. And Liv Morgan has improved. I see a little bit more and a little bit more from her each time that I see her in the ring. She had a match with Asuka a few weeks ago that I thought was very good. What was not good was her clearly forgetting her lines. I mean, look, it happens. But it made for a very awkward situation during her post-match promo. They had somebody come into the ring to interview her post-match, and she forgot her lines. She's like so many people my age, I'm still trying to figure out who I am. I guess she's, what was she supposed to be? She's just the millennial kid that is trying to figure out what she wants to do with her life. Is that her new gimmick now? She went from teasing a lesbian storyline with Lana to being a very confused millennial. Is that her new story now? Apparently she is very confused about what she wants to do. She showed up, she was in love with Lana, and now they don't mention it at all. It's just completely dropped. Completely forgotten about. It's not the writers that are confused. Obviously, it's Liv Morgan. Liv Morgan is confused about what she wants to do with her life. But she says this, and then she just looked lost. And then she repeated herself. At least I hope she forgot her lines, and they didn't actually write that for her. We got the return of the Maharaja. As if we're all not suffering enough during this pandemic. We had the return of Jinder Mahal, just in time for his former 3MB stablemate to be WWE champion. I'm sure you know it's coming. Drew McIntyre is the champion. Jinder Mahal is a former WWE champion. Now Jinder Mahal is back. They were talking about how physically great, how physically impressive Jinder Mahal looks. He got a squash win over Akira Tozawa. The same Akira Tozawa who is currently in the Interim Cruiserweight Championship Tournament on NXT. He got a win over Isaiah Swerve Scott a couple of weeks ago. Why the hell would you put Akira Tozawa in there? You are literally running in the Performance Center. You've got your pick of any number of Performance Center people. I don't even know all their names. You've had squash matches after squash matches every single week, and they put Akira Tozawa in there to be squashed by Jinder Mahal? The guy's in the tournament. Who thought of that? Who made that call? Idiots. We had a contract signing with Drew McIntyre and Seth Rollins signing for their championship match at Money in the Bank. Rollins was out there in a suit, a glove on his hand, looking like Agent 47. Rollins, at first, he resisted signing the contract. He had a little something to say. He's talking about how, Drew, you're going to be a great WWE champion one day, but you are not a leader. I am a leader. The WWE universe needs me. It's not that I want to be the champion. I have to be the champion. Sounds like a Triple H back in the day making his case in one of the production meetings, or Hulk Hogan. I don't want to be the champion, brother. I have to be the champion, dude. Brother Jack, dude. So Rollins said that he suffered for the championship. McIntyre, though, you don't have to. I don't want you to suffer the way that I suffered. It was my burden to carry. And so then Drew thanked him for the speech. Those are some lovely words. Drew said, it's now very clear to me and to everyone else that you are completely full of shit. They didn't bleep it out. They just let it flow. You are completely full of shit, is what he said to Seth Rollins. I've been saying that for months. So Rollins finally signed the contract. And he leaned over the table. He told McIntyre to have faith. McIntyre, this is actually kind of funny. McIntyre, just as he's speaking, he grabs Seth by the head and just rams him face first down into the table. I thought that was funny. He tossed the table out of the ring. He was setting up for a Claymore kick. Murphy showed up to attack McIntyre. So now Rollins and Murphy are hugging in the middle. Talk about no social distancing here. These two have embraced. They're hugging in the middle of the ring. McIntyre flies in with a Claymore kick. And he was aiming for Rollins. Rollins moved out of the way or got shoved. I couldn't really tell. And he hit Murphy instead. I believe McIntyre and Murphy are having a non-title match on TV this week. Rollins and McIntyre, I thought, were really good here. Drew McIntyre, he's a natural, I think, so far in this role. He comes out, he looks the part as the champion. He looks like he's having fun out there. He's in his comfort zone when it comes to promos, getting better and better each time I hear him. He's this big, believable guy in the role. And it's unfortunate that this is coming for him at a time when he doesn't have the people to feed off of. Hopefully, you know, that fan support will still be there when this all blows over eventually. Who even knows? But I think it's worth mentioning and giving him some credit because I don't think it gets talked about enough that it's only been a few weeks. You know, he hasn't even defended the championship on pay-per-view yet. He'll do that next Sunday. But I like what I'm seeing. I still like what I'm seeing, even post-WrestleMania here from Drew McIntyre. I think he's doing very well. So I thought, and Seth is much better as a heel than he was last year as a babyface. I don't even think anybody can debate that. I don't think there can be any debate. I know Seth Rollins can be this hot, you know, fiery babyface from back during his Shield run when he would make those hot tags and he would run wild, but some of these singles runs that he's had in recent years, he is a much better heel than he is as a babyface. So I thought it was a good ending to a bad show. I thought this was a bad Monday Night Raw. Good ending, though. But overall, did not really do much at all to get me excited for Money in the Bank. And I do have an update on the whereabouts of Kevin Owens. Kevin Owens gave an interview to a Canadian outlet called RDS, and he confirmed that he has been off WWE television since WrestleMania because he opted to be at home with his family. But he also admitted that he suffered an ankle injury. He's not sure if it's a fracture, a small fracture, or a sprain. Suffered some kind of ankle injury at WrestleMania, jumping off the sign onto Seth Rollins. He's going to have x-rays done to evaluate and see exactly how serious the injury is. It doesn't sound too serious, but I guess until you have x-rays, you don't really know for sure. But there you have it. It was his call to stay home and be with his family, which would explain why Seth Rollins, out of nowhere, got the championship shot against Drew McIntyre with no explanation at all about what happened to Kevin Owens. Now we know. SmackDown on Fox. It was confirmed on SmackDown this week that both the men's and women's Money in the Bank ladder matches at WWE headquarters, which have already been taped, will be taking place simultaneously. I believe with one ring on the roof and both briefcases hanging one right next to the other. Ryan Satin said that he heard the idea floated that the matches would actually be taking place throughout the pay-per-view, with commentary checking in on things between, I guess, all of the other matches that are going to be happening at the Performance Center. It sounds, when you hear that concept, it sounds very busy, almost just too busy trying to pay attention to everything that's going on. But again, anything beats doing these matches in an empty PC. So I'm all for the idea, and I'm very curious to see how this plays out. You got to try new things. You have to. You have to try new things. This is something different. If they're shooting these matches cinematically, which apparently they are, you can get away with doing cut-ins on the matches. That works better than if the matches are filmed like a movie. It actually works better that way. You know, after one match, let's cut to the men. Let's see what part of the building the men are in. Let's see what they're up to. Then maybe cut to the ladies in a different part of the building, a different section of the floor. You know, Titan Tower is a big building. I don't know how many stories it is, but it's a big building. Then cut back to the live matches at the Performance Center, and then cut back again, back and forth. So that could work. They would end up being the longest Money in the Bank matches in history. If they technically go all the way through the pay-per-view from start to finish, then they would easily be the longest, maybe the longest matches, period, in WWE history. So I am really looking forward to this. I am looking forward to seeing this, because either way, good or bad, it gives me something to talk about on the recap right after. It's good content for me. So I am all for it. But no, I like the concept. I gotta say, I can't hate on the concept. I know it sounds very busy. You know, they're doing too much at once. Maybe they are. But I like that they're at least doing something different. What I am not all for is opening this show on Friday with 15 minutes of Baron Corbin. Now, granted, it was against Daniel Bryan. I like Daniel Bryan, but still. Don't do that again. These are two of the participants here in the Men's Money in the Bank match. We got a cheap disqualification ending with Corbin hitting him with a ladder. They have announced that Daniel Bryan, Drew Gulak, and a mystery partner will team up next week on SmackDown on the go-home show against Corbin, Cesaro, and Nakamura. Apparently, Sami Zayn has opted to stay home, and since everybody has that option, even though he is the Intercontinental Champion, that's where he is. I don't think he's hurt or anything like that. He's at home. And so that's why he was not on TV this week. And apparently he will not be on the show next week either. So the question is, who is the mystery partner? It seems pretty obvious to me. It will likely be Elias. But we'll see. Maybe it won't be. Maybe it'll be a new face debuting from NXT. It'll be Elias. I'm sure it will be Elias. Braun Strowman. Braun Strowman was in the ring when he was interrupted by Bray Wyatt in the Funhouse, who was going to read to him a special story called The Black Sheep. Black Sheep is also a very good movie, as is Tommy Boy, Chris Farley and David Spade. So he was going to read him a story. Story time with Bray. And in this story, a shepherd, hopefully not Brad, spotted a black sheep wandering alone. He brought that black sheep home. He raised that sheep. All was well until one day the sheep left without saying so much as thank you or goodbye. All of his other animals left him too. Then the government came in and took his farm, and the reptilian showed up. It sounds like something you would hear on Alex Jones's show. Now he's going to take that black sheep, he says, to the slaughterhouse. Strowman said, I'm sick of the puppets. Get your ass down here. Come meet me in the ring face to face. And Bray just stared at him and then waved goodbye. And that was the end of the segment. And next Friday on SmackDown on the Go Home Show, they are promoting a face-to-face with the two of them. You know, obviously in this story, Bray is the shepherd. Braun was the sheep, wandering aimlessly. Now he's going to turn that ungrateful sheep into a pair of Ugg boots. So I think the story is fine. I think the match is probably going to suck. And they could probably, you know, get away with Bray losing if the Fiend then returns to avenge the loss. They can stretch this out and get another match out of it. Because at some point, it's got to be Fiend and Braun. Can't just end with Braun and Bray. You know, even if Bray were to win, there still has to be a confrontation between the Fiend and Braun Strowman, which is clearly what this is building to. We got a video package for Jeff Hardy, video package number 4, The Comeback. We've had The Fall, we've had The Redemption, now it's The Comeback. Talking about his knee injury last year, when he and Matt then had to relinquish their tag team titles. Right? They had the SmackDown tag team titles, I think, and they had to give them up because Jeff needed the surgery. And his comeback from that, Sheamus, after his latest squash match, and they played that video, and he walked over to Michael Cole. He was very excited that Jeff Hardy was going to be in attendance next week. He will be here to meet Jeff Hardy. You know, ever since they decided to pull that men's Elimination Chamber match, the one that was going to have Roman Reigns and probably Baron Corbin, and we all knew who was going to win anyway, so they just decided to ixnay the entire thing. Sheamus had already gone on television and talked about being in the men's Elimination Chamber, and then they had no Elimination Chamber. They had one for the women. They didn't have one for those guys. And then WrestleMania comes and goes. 18 matches on the WrestleMania card. I think it actually ended with 19, technically, if you count that Big Show match. 19 matches at WrestleMania this year. Sheamus was not in one of them. He has been directionless. He has been treading water. He's beating jabrones on TV every week. That can only go on for so long. I'm glad they settled on an opponent for him, and I think he and Jeff could work well together. I don't think I've ever seen them work together. If they did, maybe it was like a one-off match on TV, but I think there could be some good chemistry there between them. Carmella pinned Mandy Rose to advance to the women's Money in the Bank. Carmella is technically a 2-time Money in the Bank match winner, although it was for the same briefcase. They just redid the one match, but she is technically a 2-time winner. I predict that she will not 3-peat at the pay-per-view. I know that's a bold prediction, but Carmella will not 3-peat at the pay-per-view. Now, the reason that she pinned Mandy Rose to qualify is because Sonya Deville walked out in the middle of the match with a microphone in her hand, and she began berating Mandy, distracting Mandy. That led to Mandy losing. After the match was over, Sonya gave her this vicious beating and vowed to ruin her life. I thought Sonya Deville was great. I got crazy Victoria vibes from the way she was, you know, pulling her hair and everything and acting all crazy, which is not a bad thing. I think she's been doing a tremendous job since the big reveal before WrestleMania. She has run with it. She's been one of the bright spots, I think, on this SmackDown show. The Forgotten Sons of Anarchy beat the New Day when Wesley Blake pinned Kofi Kingston. Wesley Blake now has a pinfall win over the former WWE champion. How the mighty have fallen. Now, on the one hand, it's nice to see them give a win to a new team. On the other hand, it's the Forgotten Sons. So I'm conflicted on this. It's like that scene with Larry David at the end of that Palestinian Chicken episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm. I don't know which side I want to be on. But they have a fatal four-way to fill up for the pay-per-view. It's been announced that the New Day will defend the titles against Miz and Morrison, the Lucha Block Party, and the Forgotten Sons, which explains why they had the Lucha House Party beat Miz and Morrison a couple of weeks ago on TV. They've got to find a way to justify these teams being in this match and getting a tag team title shot. These wins, you know, they can go out there, the Lucha guys can go out there and beat Miz and Morrison, and, you know, the Forgotten Sons can beat the New Day. That's all well and good. these matches, these wins, they don't mean anything. They don't mean anything unless they are sustained. These teams need sustained victories in order to, I think, have people take them seriously and believe in them in being in that position. Otherwise, this is all pointless. Now, you might be asking, well, what about the Usos? How come they're not in the match? Jimmy Uso apparently hurt his knee during the ladder match of WrestleMania. I think there was a spot in that match where Kofi, I think, threw a ladder at his knee. I don't know if that's where it happened, but in any event, he suffered a knee injury, and he is going to be out in the Uso infirmary anywhere from 6 to 9 months. I hear 6 to 9 months. That sounds to me like an ACL surgery. Whatever type of injury it is, obviously it's pretty serious if he's going to be out up to 9 months. And Otis beat Dolph Ziggler in the main event to secure his spot in the men's Money in the Bank match. Otis is my wild card. If AJ Styles does not get into this Money in the Bank match, I know Aleister Black is the prevailing favorite probably amongst a lot of people. He really does not need the briefcase. Otis winning is a real possibility. And then it just becomes a question of who screws him when he eventually cashes in. Mandy or Tucker? Probably Tucker. Right? Afraid that if Otis wins the championship, he's going to be forgotten. Which he probably would be. But I would not count Otis out. I don't think Otis is just a warm body in there. I think Otis has a real shot if AJ does not get into that match. It was a Lucha Underground reunion to open NXT this week. King Cuerno against Killshot. Or El Hijo del Fantasma against Isaiah Swerve Scott. God, do I miss that show. God, do I miss that show. I went on their YouTube channel because they did wrestle once before in Lucha Underground. It was 5 years ago during season one. We had Killshot had a match with King Cuerno. Cuerno won that match. And I found it. It's on their YouTube channel. Because it's been a while since I've gone back and watched any of the Lucha Underground stuff. And I believe, I don't remember if it's the Pluto, it might be Pluto TV or Buzzy. It might be Buzzy TV. There's different like TV apps you can watch, these free channels. It's one of them. It's either Pluto or Buzzy. Has, I believe, all of the episodes from all 4 seasons of Lucha Underground. If you ever want to just go for free, bring it up on your phone or your tablet, your device, and watch it. And I'm watching this and I'm like, man, do I miss these shows. You know, you had the people in the temple, you know, you had Stryker and Vampira, who I thought were a good announced team. They could be a little much at times, but just everything about that show, Dario Cueto and you know, some of the characters, Mil Muertes and Katrina and Pentagon Jr. when he was really starting to get over here on the, in the States and make a name for himself here. So I do miss that show. So we got a little bit of a Lucha Underground flavor here at the beginning. This match was a Group B match in the interim Cruiserweight title tournament. This was good. Phantasma hit the big dive out through the ropes, the missile dive out of the ring. He went for the thrill of the hunt back inside, which I guess they're calling the Phantom Driver. But Swerve slipped out, used this wacky Lucha Cradle to crucifix his shoulders down for the pin. So Isaiah Swerve Scott moves to 1-1. In the tournament, as does Phantasma. During the break, the masked Lucha ninjas from the parking lot, right? The parking lot van that have been kidnapping people. They either tried to beat up Phantasma or tried to abduct him. This time this was inside the building, not in the parking lot. But he fought them off again. Second time he's fought them off and they ran away. I'm thinking he may be in on this. It is too convenient that he is the only person now, successive times, who has been able to fight these guys off. Unless he's going to feud with them, he could be leading them. And maybe he's trying to swerve all of us. Johnny Gargano is now coming out with Candice, his wife, for her matches. I guess they're the new power couple. Only without any actual power. They have no titles. But I guess they're the new power couple in NXT. Candice got a win over Casey Catanzaro, using the old Paul Burchill-style curb stomp as her new finish. Actually, people are going to yell at me if they think I'm giving credit to Paul Burchill for it. Is it from Chikara? Who was the one that really started using that variation of a curb stomp? Was it Super Dragon? I think it was Super Dragon. I look at it because that was the move that Pirate Paul Burchill used back when he had his brief run in WWE, which I actually think is a far more vicious curb stomp than any that I've ever seen Seth Rollins use on TV. So basically, you know, she crosses the legs or the ankles, pulls back on Casey's arms, and then uses her one available foot, her one free foot, to stomp the shit out of her. She calls it the Wicked Stepsister. And it looked positively brutal. She stomped this poor girl's face into the mat so hard I'd be surprised if it didn't leave an indentation in the mat. After the match, she locked her in the Gargano Escape for good measure. Then we got comedy, which can be very hit or miss when it comes to WWE. NXT is not immune. We got a comedy segment involving NXT Tag Team Champions Matt Riddle and Timothy Thatcher, a takeoff of the Newlywed Game called the Newly Bro Show. Byron Saxton was out as the cheesy game show host. He was hamming it up even more than he usually does. He did have a pretty bitchin' suit on. I'll give him that. I did like his suit. They played a laugh track in the background. Yeah, it was corny, but you know what? It was nice to hear actual people. They ought to play a laugh track for most of the shit they give us on Monday nights. Anyway, Matt Riddle was Matt Riddle. Matt Riddle can only play one role. That's all, the only role he can play is Matt Riddle. You know, some of these wrestlers that go on to have Hollywood careers, you know, The Rock, John Cena. I think Roman Reigns at some point could be one of those guys. Becky Lynch is starting to branch out a little bit. She's going to be, I heard, making an appearance on that show Billions, which I have to start. People have told me. Actually, Noah told me I have to start Billions. I haven't started it yet. So anyway, we'll see about that. But if Matt Riddle were to become a big name on the main roster, and 5 years from now, Hollywood came calling, hey, we want you, bro. We want to put you in a movie. We want to put you on a TV show. Can you picture Matt Riddle being anything other than Matt Riddle? Just looking and sounding anything other than the way Matt Riddle looks and sounds? Because I can't. I don't know if he has it in him. And Matt Riddle is a great Matt Riddle, but I don't think Matt Riddle could be anybody else. You know, they're not going to have Matt Riddle playing Abraham Lincoln in a movie. That's just not going to work. Although now that I say that, I kind of want to see that. So Riddle was Riddle. Thatcher played the straight man, just like Steve Blackman used to what I would say is Riddle's Al Snow. Remember Head Cheese? I got a lot of Blackman vibes here from Thatcher. So Byron would ask a series of questions, ask Riddle to write his answers down on a whiteboard, and we would have to see if Timothy Thatcher, how well do you know your tag team partner? We would have to see if Timothy Thatcher would correctly guess the answers that Matt Riddle would be writing down. So he asked Riddle, what did you have for breakfast this morning? He asked Thatcher, what do you think Matt had for breakfast? And Thatcher said, I don't know. I have no idea. And Riddle reveals that he wrote down, I have no idea. So they got the first question right. Then he asked Thatcher, he goes, what's your favorite TV show? And Thatcher said, I don't own a TV. And Byron said, well, would you consider buying one? And he said, well, you know, they're kind of expensive, but, you know, if the price was right. And then we see that Matt wrote down The Price is Right as his favorite TV show. Really corny, cheesy stuff. Then we had the final question. What is the craziest place as a professional wrestler? I was shocked they called him that. They called him a professional wrestler. That's how you know this is the Triple H show. This is not the Vince McMahon show. What is the craziest place that you've done it? Thatcher said, well, you know, probably the wrestling ring, but I did once have a triple threat in a laundromat. And Riddle guessed threesome on a washer. And he spelled it with the number 3, and he spelled the word S-U-M. Threesome. I guess because all stoners are bad spellers, too. So they were about to get to the speed round. Riddle said, speed isn't really my thing, bro. And then he got attacked from behind by Fabian Aichner, Marcel Bartel of Imperium. They left the champions laying, posed with the title. So at least the segment served a purpose. It led to something. The comedy was campy. I liked it. You know, I like the chemistry and the interplay more between Riddle and Pete Dunne. But, you know, Thatcher is cut from the same cloth, I think, as a Pete Dunne in a lot of ways. So you kind of get those similar vibes. You know, again, the straight guy, the guy that just wants to have fun and just relax and be all chill. All Thasher wants to do is just get in street fights and beat people up. So I liked it. But again, I got Steve Blackman vibes from Timothy Thatcher. The stupid Viking karaoke thing on Raw last week was just dumb. And apparently they realized it was dumb, because this week there was no mention of it, there was no follow-up on it. In fact, we got a typical kind of serious Viking Raiders promo in the back, and they're going to be meeting the Street Profits on TV this Monday. So that carpool karaoke nonsense or whatever they did with them was a fail. This was okay. I liked this. Adam Cole. Adam Cole cut a promo elsewhere. I think he was in the back. Hyping up his NXT Championship match this Wednesday with the Velveteen Dream. So they're finally doing the match. Cole called himself the greatest NXT champion that there's ever been. Might not be the best time to be talking about your peen when talking about the Velveteen Dream. Good match on the show between Charlotte and Mia Yim, with Charlotte going over figure eight, went about 10 minutes. Had the story built into it where, you know, when Charlotte first came to NXT, Mia Yim was her opponent, and here we are now, full circle, kind of. And Charlotte, no surprise here, picks up the win as she should have. Io Shirai, her music hits after the match. She comes out, she says to Charlotte, she shouts a bunch of Japanese at her, and then she says, "Next week, you're mine." Now remember, she won that ladder match a few weeks ago on TV to earn a championship match. Apparently, she's going to be cashing in that opportunity next week. So we're getting Charlotte Flair against Io Shirai this Wednesday on NXT for the NXT Women's Championship. They are loading this show up. We have that match. Finn Balor is going to be back to reveal who attacked him in the back a couple of weeks ago. Killer Cross is going to be in that, probably not wrestling, but making his debut appearance with Scarlett this week. Johnny Gargano, I believe, has a one-on-one match with Dominik Dijakovic. And Adam Cole is defending the NXT title against the Velveteen Dream. So NXT is not playing around this week. If they don't beat AEW with a lineup like that, that will not be a good look. AEW is going to be live this Wednesday. They're back to being live. So this will be an interesting head-to-head matchup on Wednesday. Dexter Lumis got a win over Shane Thorne. I only noticed it this week, but I like how they announced Lumis as hailing from Recluse, Wyoming, which is a real place. Reminds me of Isaac Yankum, DDS, coming from Decatur, Illinois. We had Drake Maverick fighting for his job, which he's already lost. I guess he's not really fighting for his job so much as he's fighting to be the champ. Well, I guess storyline-wise, if he was to become the champion, I mean, is his thought process that I have to win the championship because if I win the title, then I have to keep my job and they can't fire me? Because I'm not so sure that's the case. But then again, if he won the championship and they just stripped him, that would defeat the whole purpose of having an interim cruiserweight title tournament. You'd have to have another one. So I guess in a way he is fighting for his job against Tony Nese. Group A match in the cruiserweight title tournament. Again, they're playing up the whole underdog story with Maverick. It might make for a good story on their TV show, but if this guy really did lose his job, I just think this whole thing is just doing this is completely ridiculous, but whatever, I've said my piece. They're heading up top. Maverick misses an elbow off the top. Nese goes up top, gets cut off, and Maverick pulled off a top rope avalanche bulldog and got the win. So Tony Nese, I believe, is the only person yet to win a match in this tournament. Drake Maverick moves to, 1-1 here in the Cruiserweight title tournament. And Keith Lee successfully defended his North American Championship in the main event over Damian Priest. Damian Priest needs a title. I don't know why this guy isn't a champion yet. He just, I don't know. He's got that look. He's you know, good in the ring. Great promo. Great voice for a promo. Good talker. Got to get a belt on this guy, but if not this belt, then what other belt is there? You know, they're not going to put the NXT title on him yet. He's not going to be the Cruiserweight champion. Tag team, I mean, could put him with a partner. I wouldn't do that. So he had his shot here with the North American Championship, and he got beat. They had a spot where Keith Lee This was very impressive. Keith Lee did a deadlift superplex to Priest, who is a big man, deadlifted him up for a superplex off the top rope, only got a near fall out of it. Priest hit the choke bomb. Lee kicked out. So he goes outside. Priest grabs the North American title belt, but he also grabs the baton that he has been using. He's used it on Lee before as a weapon. The championship, that was just a distraction. The referee clearly saw the belt. He said, all right, here you go. And he gave the belt to the referee for the referee to dispose of, but in his other hand, he had the baton. He tried to use the baton, and Keith Lee blocked it. He grabbed it. And I thought this was really ridiculous. This was just cheesy. He stands there and he goes, I think it was something to the effect of, I am limitless. I'm like, I just laughed. Who would stand there and say that? You know what I mean? I guess his catchphrase or nickname or whatever, but I am limitless. What are you, He-Man? I have the power. Just shut up. Just shut up and wrestle. And he did. He hit the power bomb twice. Two power bombs. Spirit bomb. To Damian Priest for the win. So Keith Lee gets a big win here on NXT. Again, I'm conflicted. I'm not ready for Keith Lee's run to end. He's having a nice run as the North American champion. But I just look at a guy like Damian Priest and I just think to myself, this guy should have a title. This guy should have something going for him. He keeps losing. I don't think he should keep losing unless they're going to promote him to the main roster. You know, we get Punishment Martinez on Raw, or maybe Punishment Martinez on... I still call him Punishment Martinez, but you know, we get Damian Priest on Raw or SmackDown. You know, that might not be such a bad thing. I have more faith in them doing right by him just because he's a big guy. He's a big, tall guy, 6'7", I think, whatever he is. I think he'll have a better go at things on the main roster maybe than some other people would. So I enjoyed, some of the action on NXT this week. But again, they're loading that thing up on Wednesday. So I think Wednesday is going to be a fun night. I'll be live on YouTube as I am every week. I am kind of, part of me wants to go live after, the shows and review NXT. But truth be told, and I've said this before, and I've noticed it even recently when I put limited NXT content from this show and I kind of clip it and put it on YouTube, the NXT content is some of the worst performing content on YouTube. It's just, and I don't think I'm the only one who's experienced this. If I hear from other content creators, I guess they'll share their own stories with me. But, I could have an AEW video that, is clipped from this show that I'll put up and, maybe that'll do 10, 12, 15,000 views. The streams are down a little bit, but I expected them to be. If they were averaging 14 to 17,000, now it's down to like 9, 10, 11. But the NXT content, it doesn't matter what's going on in NXT. It's been this way for a few years. It's not like a new phenomenon. You could have videos that are, on the lower end on the channel, might be doing 7, 6, 7, 8,000. Usually they do a lot more than that. And the NXT content is down there at 4,000. 5,000, maybe 6. It's just that thirst for NXT is not there the way it is for the main roster. It's not there the way it is even for AEW, and I'm just saying that out of my own personal experience, looking at the numbers. I think all the AEW fans would be disappointed. So we'll go live after AEW. We'll talk about Dynamite on Wednesday, and we'll talk more about NXT on the podcast next Sunday on 651. And as I'm sitting here, I get a spam email that I will read to you here for comedic purposes, if nothing else, from a Magani Osura with the headline, "Excuse for my intrusion, ? I apologize for my intrusion into your privacy, especially through this medium. For a transaction of this magnitude, due to its urgency, it becomes paramount for me to seek your assistance." Go sit on a rusty nail, you prick. What do they get out of these emails? Yeah, do they actually get people who are gullible enough to respond to them? I guess they probably do. They probably prey on old people, stupid people. Thankfully, I'm not either one of those things. But I wonder what the return rate is for people on those emails when they send stupid stuff out to people like that. What are they getting out of this? I had somebody the other day say to me, that it was like an inheritance, one of these inheritance emails, And apparently I guess I had some kind of relative in South Africa that I was unaware of, and I had some kind of inheritance in Bitcoin. And they needed some personal information from me. I'll get right on that. Let's talk about Dark Side of the Ring. I am recording this here in the year 2020. 36 years ago, 2020 was a news magazine show on ABC, which is still on the air. I talk about it in the past tense. I mean, 2020 is still on the air. But back then it was hosted by, I'll never forget, Hugh Downs and Barbara Walters. I can still remember the intro to the show. Now, here's Hugh Downs and Barbara Walters. Hugh Downs was old even then. I thought he was dead. I looked him up. He's still alive, apparently. I was shocked. I mean, good for him, but I don't know. I just thought Hugh Downs was long gone. Apparently, he's still kicking. But back then, it was a very popular show, more than it is even today. And they were the hosts when I was a kid. And I also remember watching, you know, Maury Povich. He hosted a little show back then called A Current Affair with that synthesized swooshing sound that opened every show. It's still seared into my brain to this day. But back in early 1985, 2020 aired an expose on the professional wrestling business that is still talked about to this day, less so because of how it exposed the business, more so because of an incident that took place involving Dr. D, David Schultz, and a reporter for 2020 by the name of John Stossel. One of the most believable heels of that era. And Dr. D. So Dr. D, if I didn't know any better, if you had shown me a picture or if you had, you know, shown me a promo of Dr. D, I would say that Schultz was a dead ringer for Stone Cold Steve Austin. Only with curly blonde hair, which I have to say, and I wouldn't say this to his face. He has a very large gun collection. I would not say this to his face. But as tough as Dr. D is and probably was back then, I don't know what he was thinking with that hair. I look at these pictures of him back in the 70s and the early 80s with that big, it's almost like a curly blonde fro that he had. I don't know what he was thinking. There's no way that could have been a cool hairdo even in 1979. So I don't know what was going on with the hair. But if you took a Psycho Sid blonde macaroni wig and you put it on Schultz's head, you would have Steve Austin. It's uncanny. Right down to the speech pattern, right down to some of the words that he would use. Austin once said that Dave Schultz was the first Stone Cold Steve Austin. But he never saw much of him on television growing up. So he was not really an influence on Austin. Austin has never said, oh, well, I was influenced by David Schultz. I watched him when I was a kid. He couldn't. So he actually doesn't credit him as an influence because he never watched him. But the similarities there are uncanny. So Dark Side of the Ring this week looked at the career of David Schultz, which pretty much came to an end after two open hand slaps to John Stossel backstage at Madison Square Garden. When Stossel told Schultz to his face that he thought wrestling was fake, which was a big no-no back then. You wouldn't even do that today. If you had a reporter doing an interview backstage at a WWE show today, and they went up to Roman Reigns, or they went up to Bray Wyatt, or they went up to Daniel Bryan and said, I think what you do is fake, I would say that's completely inappropriate, and they may get slapped even today, depending on who you say that to. Maybe Daniel Bryan wouldn't slap him, but there are some people who probably would haul off and knock him into the middle of next week. So that's just not something that you do. And for whatever reason, he felt that he had to ask the question. He had to ask what he said. Oh, it's the standard question. But then there was no question. He just said, I think wrestling is fake. He basically made a statement, and he got smacked. He got smacked not once, but twice. And David Schultz is probably the last person that you would have wanted to say something like that to. I mean, there were a lot of tough guys on that roster back then I wouldn't have wanted to mess with, but I don't know why you would say that to David Schultz. So the producers interviewed Dr. D for this, John Stossel, which was kind of a big get. I'm almost surprised he did it. But they interviewed Stossel. They interviewed Eddie Mansfield, the wrestler who agreed to go on camera for the Stossel 2020 piece and exposed the tricks of the wrestling business. And he ended up being blackballed because of it. And Jim Cornette, our resident wrestling historian for these episodes, which, no matter what you may think of Jim Cornette, he is very good on these shows. And not one mention of Vince Russo by Cornette. It was actually kind of refreshing. He did not mention Vince Russo even once. I was not sure how they were going to stretch this out, this one incident out to an hour for the episode, but not only did they do a good job with it, I thought this was one of the best episodes of the season. I enjoyed this more than the New Jack episode. I enjoyed this more than the Brawl for All episode. And it was a nice break to not have one episode here involving a murder. There was no death here involved in this episode other than, you know, Eddie Mansfield killing his own career. So Chris Jericho, you know, talks about how at the beginning of the century, wrestling was, it was a very closed society. You know, like Fight Club, you don't talk about Fight Club. It was a closed society. And people were not hip to the tricks of the trade and what was going on behind the scenes. And when wrestling really began to boom in the 1980s, in large part because of what Vince McMahon was doing and trying to go national and rock and wrestling and all this stuff and the Hulkamania boom, that began to change. So they cut to somewhere in Tennessee. That's what they said. Somewhere in Tennessee where we meet Dr. D. David Schultz. Because I guess when you're a bounty hunter, you probably don't want people to know exactly where you live. So I get that. But he, you know, gave us a tour of his storage unit. He's got this big storage locker out in, you know, his yard or wherever he is. And he's got all this wrestling memorabilia. He kept a lot of stuff. He also showed off the stun gun that he uses when he's out bounty hunting, which I'll get to later. Talked about how he was trained by Herb Welch, who is a very old school guy who made his trainees do some very disgusting things. So he agreed to train Dr. D. He would take him and other people and take him out back into his barn, and he would beat the piss out of him. And Schultz was so rough with the other guys. They had to smarten him up that the business was a work. It's not real, because he didn't know that. He thought it was real. So he was going in there and he was stiffing guys and beating them up, and they had to, you know, easy there. They had to calm him down and kind of tell him what was up. And that's when we get a lesson in what kayfabe is. A lot of talk about kayfabe on this show. And Schultz, as a lot of guys did back then, believed that keeping kayfabe was the single most important thing that a wrestler could do. Jim Cornette probably still feels that way to this day, which is why he always gets so pissed off and animated when he's talking about, you know, Kenny Olivier and wrestling blow-up dolls and things of that nature. It just makes his head explode because he can't wrap his head around the fact that in his mind, these guys are exposing the business. They are damaging the wrestling business. That's how Jim Cornette feels about that. So, you don't leave a show to go down the road, he says, and go share a beer with the guy that you were just beating up. You know, Schultz says you keep away from them. And you don't kill the illusion. It's an art that, you know, is today it's long gone. I mean, you see glimpses of it now and then, the whole idea that kayfabe, is kayfabe completely dead? You still see, they're trying to hold on to it. Some people try to hold on to it like you know, for their lives. There's glimpses of it that are still, you know, out there today. You may see an angle on TV that makes you think every now and then, oh, hey, you know, was that really supposed to happen? That kind of looked real. Was that a work or was that a shoot? It's rare, but it does still sometimes exist. I would not necessarily say that kayfabe is dead so much as kayfabe is an endangered species that has been mostly killed off, and there's maybe like two or three of them left out there in the wild, still roaming around. If you're lucky, you'll spot one every now and then before it disappears, kind of like Bigfoot. Schultz met Hulk Hogan. He knew they were going to talk about the relationship with him and Hogan because the two of them were thick as thieves at one point. He met Hogan for the first time down in Florida. Hogan was living in his van, so Schultz let him stay at his place. And Hogan admitted when he was on Steve Austin's podcast, he said that at one point he was sleeping in his van in a parking lot for about 3 months until Schultz took him in, and that's how they became friends. And they were doing a lot of things together. I'll leave that up to your imagination. They were doing a lot of things back then. And it wasn't long before Vince McMahon came calling, and Schultz says that Hogan went to WWE for the money. Of course. Plain and simple, he went there for the money. That's why he left Vern. Hogan and Schultz, they were still having matches together in the AWA as late as October of 83. That's the latest record I could find of Hogan and Schultz matches in the AWA. And you'll find a couple of them on YouTube, and places going wild, and Hulk Hogan's coming out to Eye of the Tiger, and man, it just feels like this big-time match, you know? The big hero against the villain, Hogan and Schultz, you know, oil and water. Couldn't find two more polar opposite, you know, guys at the time. One is basically this big, jacked-up, bleach-blonde California bum from Venice Beach, even though he, you know, technically he was born in Georgia, lived in Tampa, where all of his neighbors would use... Oh, well, we won't get into that, but... And then you have Schultz over here, who's this redneck from Tennessee. Hates everybody, hates the world, hates people. So they did big business together in the AWA. They were still wrestling against each other as late as October of 83. I think Hogan wrestled his last match for Vern in November of 83. Left. Didn't give any notice. Actually, no, I think he did give notice, but Vern, I think the story is that Vern thought it was a prank. He didn't take it seriously, but he was gone. He was serious. Hogan took the money. He took the top spot that Vince promised him in the WWF. Gagne did the cock tease with Hogan and the AWA title so many times. Never went with him as the champion. He'd win the title, but it was like a dusty finish. He didn't really win the title. He didn't really beat Bockwinkel for it. And Vince came along and promised him the world. He promised him fame and fortune and money and the top spot and the championship. I'm going national. I'm going big. I want you to be my guy. I mean, I would have made the same decision that Hogan made. I would have been out of there. Don't blame Hogan for that. And the rest is history. Schultz, he eventually followed Hogan to the WWF the following year. Vince McMahon wanted to program him as Hogan's top rival. He saw what they were doing in the AWA. He wanted to replicate that in WWE. I will never not be able, though, I have to say this about Schultz in the AWA. I will never not be able to watch that one David Schultz promo where he talks about looking for a woman in San Francisco and not being able to find one and watching Gene Okerlund corpse to the point where he had to turn away because he just couldn't hide. The fact that he was about to just bust at the seams. And Schultz never cracked once. He just looks over and goes, "What's wrong with you, Gene?" Never misses a beat. I laugh every time. If I need a laugh, I could always bring up that promo. So they show clips from the TNT segment. Oh boy. The TNT segment, Tuesday Night Titans. It was the March 1st, 1985 episode, which is on the WWE Network. I mentioned the date in case you want to go on the network and look it up. The episode is on there. David Schultz was a guest. Actually, before I even get to David Schultz, there was another very interesting guest sitting in the, not the couch, but in the chair being interviewed by Vince McMahon, who thought he was apparently David Letterman having his own talk show. Rita Marie. Rita Marie was a guest on that very same episode, sitting there and talking to Vince McMahon. She was the first ever female referee in the WWF. You know, they make a big deal now about they have female referees in NXT in the main roster, but long before the women they have now being referees on TV, or, you know, you've got Aubrey Edwards in AEW, and that's great, but WWF had their first female referee as far back as 1985? Yeah, I guess it would have been 85. Late 84, early 85 is when she would have debuted. But it was very awkward watching Vince McMahon introduce her and interact with her, given the very serious allegations that she made against him years later, which I'm not going to get into. But I was watching this. I brought this up on the network after I watched the Dark Side episode. I brought this up on the network, and I'm watching this, and I see Rita Marie, and she's telling her story, and she reminded me of Charlotte Flair. Not in the looks. I mean, she was blonde, but not in the looks department, but in this way. She said that she was living her brother's dream. This was not her dream to be in wrestling. This was her brother's dream. Her younger brother was killed in a car accident, and one of his dreams was to become a professional wrestler. And so she decided to train, and ultimately she decided to be a referee and not a wrestler. But Charlotte has said that she's not living her dream. She's living her brother's dream. her brother Reed was training to become a wrestler, passed away, and now she is living his dream. I just thought their story sounded very similar. But anyway, Schultz comes out later on. He's sitting down for an interview with Vince McMahon. He's got Lord Alfred Hayes to his right, Vince McMahon to his left. And on that same episode, Vince McMahon is openly bringing up the John Stossel interview. This is not something they were trying to hide from. Vince brought it up as a way to put Schultz over as an even bigger heel, which I think lends credence to his whole argument that Vince McMahon kind of wanted him to do what he did, but we'll get to that. So then, as Schultz is sitting there, this was wild just to watch this back. He's sitting there, and he reaches into his vest. He has a vest on. Reaches into his vest, and he pulls out this giant handgun and just points it in Vince's direction. I'm watching this going, this is insane. So then they do a skit from what was supposed to be his gun room in his home, which is ridiculous because, I mean, that ends, they go to commercial, they come back, they're in his home. That's stupid. Clearly they're not in his home, but they're in his gun room. And they showed this, actually. They showed this as part of the Dark Side episode. And one of the guns was made to, it was rigged, you know, to go off when he fired it, probably shooting blanks. And Vince McMahon flips out as only Vince McMahon can. He flipped out in a very convincing way when that gun went off. He flipped out on Schultz until Schultz grabbed another loaded gun. All of a sudden, Vince calmed down. His whole attitude, his whole demeanor changed. He's yelling at him, you stupid idiot, what the hell's wrong with you? And Schultz picks up the other gun and Vince goes, oh, wait a minute, all right, calm down now. He says, calm down, we're all good here. We're all good. We got nothing, we got no problem here. I'm going to walk away. How about that? I'm going to leave. Vince was great in this segment. I have to say, he made it seem like it was a real, he was, you know, it was a real botch, but it was all designed to get David Schultz over as this crazy redneck from Tennessee. Schultz was actually fired a couple of weeks before this even aired on TV. He was already gone by the time this aired. They also talked on the Dark Side episode about the At Home with Dr. D segment, another infamous segment, where he invited a WWF camera crew to come down to his home. And he had an actor playing his wife. He had a couple of child actors playing his kids. And, you know, he's talking down to him. He's kind of roughhousing one of the kids a little bit. In his RF video shoot, he said that the kids cried after the first take. He had to remind them, it's all for show. I'm not really mad at you. Don't worry. They were in tears, these kids. He says Vince McMahon had told him after that aired that the sheriff's department and the state police came to his office the Monday morning after it aired, wanting to know Schultz's address because they had warrants for his arrest for child abuse and spousal abuse. And Schultz said, look, you know, those guns in the TNT skit, those weren't my guns. Vince had somebody bring the guns in for the sketch. For the other one, same thing. It wasn't my house. It wasn't my wife. It wasn't my kids. That was all Vince McMahon's idea to get people to hate him. And the more they hated him, he said, the more money that they would make. And it worked. It was very smart. It was very smart. You know, that's real character development. It worked a little too well, but it worked. So then we meet John Stossel. This episode certainly did not do anything to change my opinion of him, which was not very high to begin with. I don't even know if he's still on TV anymore. If he is, then he must be banished to some channel I don't have, which is fine with me. At the time, he was a consumer reporter for ABC, who went after shady businesses. You know, probably where you live. We have that here in New York, where your local TV stations might have that one consumer reporter that has a segment. We had a segment on CBS, who was it? Arnold Diaz, maybe. I don't think he does it anymore, called Shame on You. You know, they get messages from people who have been scammed or screwed over in some way, and they would go, whether it's a shady landlord or some kind of shady business, and they would take a camera crew and they would go to confront them. You know, I think a lot of TV stations have that probably all across the country. So that was the kind of thing that Stossel was doing at that time. He was a wrestler, he says, back in his high school days, and it annoyed him that there were people out there who thought pro wrestling was real. This bothered him. He says it's a business based on bullshit, cleverly done athletic bullshit, but he says it was based on lies. And they had found that a third of the people that they polled, they did a poll, I guess, or somebody did a poll, they got the results, and he claims that they had found a third of the people polled thought pro wrestling was real, and it bothered him greatly that people were being bamboozled by these promoters and these wrestlers. I don't really understand, outside of maybe thinking it might be a good television ratings draw for 2020. I don't get what the point of this even was. You know, I don't buy this holier-than-thou sanctimonious crap from Stossel that, you know, I just had to expose the wrestling business because people were being scammed. I'm doing this for the greater good. No, you're not. Kids believe in the Easter Bunny. They believe in Santa Claus. You're gonna go to the North Pole and shove a camera in his face and try to expose him too? Kids believe in the Easter Bunny. They believe in Santa Claus until that one day they don't. No one is making a federal case out of it. Wrestling was kind of like that for a lot of adults. Like, they knew, but they didn't really think about it. They just wanted to go and get lost in it and have a good time and cheer the good guys and boo the bad guys. And yeah, there were people out there who truly believed it was real. You have those naive people who are out there even still to this day who would insist it was real. I'm grateful I don't live near any of these people. But they are out there. They do exist. But even back then, most of them knew what the score was. There's this belief that even back in 1984 and 1985, like, the majority of wrestling fans thought it was real. There was some other poll, I gotta see if I could look it up, from some newspaper back then, and it's just one poll, but the vast majority of people knew that pro wrestling was not real. It was not a case where in 85 they thought it was real. No, the majority of people, even in the mid-80s, knew that pro wrestling was not real. This was not some kind of big, giant expose here. You know, the majority knew what was up. But who cares? You know, it's entertainment. Who cares? You want to go after crooked companies and landlords and shady businesses. And believe me, the wrestling business is shady for a lot of other reasons. He could have gone after wrestling promoters for any number of things. But the idea, like, I'm doing the Lord's work because people are being bamboozled because they think wrestling is real. Shut up. All this holier-than-thou nonsense. This guy annoyed me. So Stossel says, well, I couldn't do the story without finding a wrestler to, you know, let them in, as Bray Wyatt would say. And then along came a wrestler by the name of Eddie Mansfield, who called himself the Continental Lover. It's a name that his girlfriend gave him once, and it just kind of stuck, so he started using it. He worked for different promotions, and the one thing that shocked him was the payoffs. He said the fact that the boys were getting so little from the promoters, even at sold-out shows. They had no health care, benefits, 401k. How come you don't treat wrestlers the way that professional athletes are supposed to be treated? He said he didn't quit wrestling. Wrestling quit him when he refused to give the booker at the time 20% of his money, which I guess was standard. Everybody did it. He refused. Now, he didn't say who he was referring to in the episode. I assume it was Ole Anderson, since Jim Barnett is the one who told him that it was Ole who had him blackballed from the business, and he's never wasted an opportunity, has Eddie Mansfield, in the other interviews and shoots that I've found that he's done over the years. He's never skipped an opportunity to crap all over Ole. So I assume he's referring to Ole, and probably deservedly so, because Ole Anderson was, well, I mean, Ole Anderson wasn't exactly the nicest chap. So I'm assuming that's who he was referring to. He said the boys would agree to the whole, oh yeah, 20% of my money thing, but he wouldn't agree to it. And then all of a sudden, his bookings, they just dried up. His bookings stopped. And that's when he decided, you know what? You're going to do this to me? You're going to blackball me from the wrestling business? I'm going to go on 2020 and expose the business. So he met with John Stossel and a camera crew in a ring somewhere in some gym, I guess. And they're showing him taking Stossel through the moves. Oh yeah, body slam. Anybody can do a body slam. Here, pick me up. I'll go up and I'll sell the body slam. And he's showing him body slams and chops and clotheslines and backdrops, how to punch, how to kick, how to take a turnbuckle. And you ran the guy face first into the turnbuckle pad. It doesn't hurt, see? And he's showing Stossel. And then the sin of all sins. He runs a razor blade across his forehead and he blades right there in front of John Stossel. A nice long line of blood right along his forehead. And he's teaching him. He says, you can wrap it up. Some people stick it in their cheek. Some people put it in their tights. Some people hide it in their wrist tape. Mansfield says, I did it for the boys. I did it to help the business, because he also, in the segment, you can find the entire 2020 segment, by the way, is on YouTube. Somebody uploaded the full segment as it aired, once the piece was finalized, as it aired in 1985. So you can find that. He talked about how the promoters treat the wrestlers like pieces of meat. They don't take care of them. All the things that I'm absolutely certain were true, and in some ways still are true, even to this day. There's still no health care. There's still no benefits. There's still no retirement. There's no pension. There's no 401k. You know, if you're an AEW, if you're Cody, if you're probably Kenny Omega, the Young Bucks, they're all technically executives. They're all EVPs. They probably have all those things. But generally speaking, wrestlers don't have any of that stuff, even to this day. That is true. And Schultz pipes in. He says Mansfield did it because he couldn't get work anymore. He says he wasn't worth a shit. The two of them used to be tag team partners, so they had history together. Apparently, he didn't think very highly of Eddie Mansfield. Jim Cornette chimes in. Jim Cornette has hated Mansfield's guts for years for what he did, which you would expect he would. He called him a has-been, never was, didn't have the talent, who claims he did it for the boys. See, that's my issue with Mansfield when I watch him and I listen to him here. I don't think he did what he did for the boys so much as he did it for himself. And he did it to get even with the promoters who screwed him and wouldn't book him. I think the substance of what he's saying is absolutely true. The promoters have treated a lot of the talent like second-class citizens over the years. But he makes himself out in this episode to be this... what did Chris Jericho used to call himself on TV many years ago? This paragon of virtue... Give me a break. Give me a break. And then, I haven't even gotten to the best part of this. Then comes the line of the episode. I could not believe that he said this. He must have been waiting years to use this line again, because he's used this line before in other interviews. It's like his go-to line. So he's had this one in his back pocket for a long time. He loves saying this. He said, Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, but Abraham Lincoln forgot to free the pro wrestlers. I only wish he would have tweeted it so that I can make it my sad tweet of the year. What a stupid thing to say. Last I checked, pro wrestlers had the freedom to stand up to their promoters if they wanted to. They just chose not to. They chose not to. That's their choice. Because they're too scared for their own jobs. If you got enough of them to do so, they could have done that a long time ago. Strength in numbers. Never happened. They don't do it because they either don't care, or they're too scared, or they're too damn selfish in some cases, probably, like the top guys, because they're doing well. They're making good money. There are a lot of guys in WWE and AEW and wrestling who are making really good money, and they're making a good living for themselves, even if they don't have all of those other things I just mentioned. So, hey, why ruin a good thing? It's the same reason Hulk Hogan went and snitched out Jesse Ventura to Vince McMahon before WrestleMania 2. When Jesse tried to unionize the wrestlers, he told them, I don't know what city they were in, it was right before WrestleMania 2. And he stands up in the locker room and says, look, we are never going to have more leverage than we have right now. That first WrestleMania was a big success. The second one's coming up. Three different cities, three different locations. They need us. We're never going to have more leverage than we have right now. We can stand up and band together and threaten to, you know, walk out if we don't get this list of demands, if we don't, you know, get what we deserve. He says there were no office people around, and yet somehow it got back to Vince McMahon, I think the next day, who called up Jesse all pissed off, almost fired him for it. And it wasn't until years later, under oath, in a deposition over something completely unrelated. It might have been like a video game lawsuit, some royalties lawsuit. Completely different circumstance. Jesse said to his lawyer, he said, listen, you're going to be in there with Vince, because Vince McMahon was being deposed. He said, look, see if you could find out, like, ask in a roundabout way. Ask Vince McMahon how he found out that I tried to start a union. He says his lawyer was really good, and they're in the deposition, and he brought it up. He says, has there ever been anybody who's tried to form a union, to your knowledge? And Vince said something like, oh, I think Jesse did, or I think Jesse tried. And then he asked him, he goes, how did you find out about that? And Jesse says, Vince, without hesitation, according to his lawyer, just blurted out, oh, Hogan told me. All of a sudden, Jesse and Hulk, who he says were good friends, all of a sudden, Jesse and Hulk, they weren't friends no more. Not after that. He was livid when he found out that Hogan had gone and snitched him off. But why do you think Hogan would do that? Because Hogan was the golden goose. Hogan had it. I mean, he had it made. Why would Hogan, of all people, want to be part of something like that or let something like that happen? Now it's more of an even playing field. And Hogan maybe loses some of that top guy status that he has. I mean, realistically, Hogan still would have been the top star. He still would have made a lot of money. But Hogan went and snitched off to Vince McMahon. But I heard that line about the slaves, and I damn near fell out of my chair. And he looks so proud, too, when he says it. Like, you can tell, like, he's really excited to say it. Like, it was such a clever thing he came up with. Not only that, there's a shoot, and then I'll move on. There's a shoot where he used that line years ago. And he says that he had to take it upon himself to free the pro wrestlers. And that's what I did when I did 2020. And I'm proud that I did, because now the wrestlers can make some money. So basically what he's doing, he's taking credit for the wrestlers today now that are able to go out there and make big money. You know, the righteous man, Eddie Mansfield. So Stossel felt, look, we have to ask somebody who is in the business right now for their response to all this. So he went to the big boys. He went to the WWF. And they went to Madison Square Garden. And he says Vince McMahon obviously okayed it, or else they wouldn't have been allowed into the building. It's not like they snuck in unbeknownst to Vince McMahon. It's December 28th, 1984. Schultz is in the locker room. He's putting his boots on. He's wrestling Antonio Inoki that night. In walks Vince McMahon. He tells Schultz, look, we've got a reporter here who's making a joke out of the business. I want you to go out there and do an interview with him, and I want you to just blast him. Tear his ass up, stay in character. So Stossel interviews the Iron Sheik and a few other people, and Vince says, oh, I got another guy for you. And out comes David Schultz. Schultz claims that Stossel had been asking him all kinds of questions that you didn't see in the piece. Schultz claims he has the full unedited original videotape, and you can see Stossel's really winding him up and asking him all these questions and just getting him very frustrated. And then what you see on tape is by that point he had been wound up. And Stossel then asks the standard question, which was not a question at all. It was a statement. The statement being, I think this is fake. I think wrestling is fake. And Schultz is, at that point, Schultz says, I'm thinking, well, Vince McMahon told me to stay in character, so what would Dr. D do if somebody came up to him and said that wrestling is fake? He'd slap the piss out of him. And so that's what he did. He gave Stossel an open hand slap. He says it wasn't to the ear. If you watch the foot, it does kind of look like it was to the ear. He insists he didn't smack him in the ear. He smacked him in the jaw or in the cheek. On one side, Stossel went down. And he got back up, and Schultz says, well, I was always taught that if you hit somebody and they get back up, you've got to knock him back down because you just never know what he might do. And so when Stossel gets up, he gives him an even stiffer shot to the other cheek, I guess, and knocks him down. And Stossel at that point, he goes and he runs off. And as he's running off, you see the whole time in the background, Mr. Fuji is just, he's like leaned up against the wall, like he's enjoying this. He's watching the whole thing down the hallway. He's already back in his street clothes. You see the Iron Sheik. Stossel goes running past all of them. And, you know, Eddie Mansfield claims that he told Stossel, when he met Stossel and showed him all the moves and everything, he claims that he told Stossel in advance, whatever you do, don't talk to David Schultz, because he knew what would happen. He says he warned him. Now, for what it's worth, now I heard that, I thought to myself, this guy's full of crap. How would he even know to say something like that? For what it's worth, there was a deposition later on after Stossel sued WWE, because he never sued Schultz. There was never any lawsuit against David Schultz. The lawsuit was against the World Wrestling Federation. He sued the company as part of that deposition, a copy of which claims Schultz claims to have. Stossel did admit that he was told by Eddie Mansfield to avoid David Schultz. So Stossel himself says that that's what Eddie Mansfield told him, so I'll take Mansfield at his word then. I heard that at first. I thought this guy's just making stuff up. But apparently, you know, that's in the deposition, so that is the case. Mansfield was not happy with the 2020 piece. He says he felt betrayed. He had no issue with Vince McMahon. He had no issue with the WWF. Again, he was probably very upset because now he wasn't going to be booked by Vince McMahon or the WWF. So he was very upset because he didn't have an issue with either of them. What he really wanted them to do was interview Ole Anderson and try to take down Ole for the way that Ole had treated him. But they ended up going with Vince and the WWF instead, because naturally they were the big dog in town. So why go to Ole Anderson in the NWA when you can go to this big company that's, you know, running Madison Square Garden and has the biggest star in wrestling and is looking to expand nationally? So they skipped over Ole and they went to Vince. And that upset Eddie Mansfield a great deal, because the whole point of him doing this was to get back at Ole. And instead they went to Vince McMahon. So Schultz slaps him. He goes out for his match that night with Inoki. He loses to Inoki. He gets to the back and Vince tells him, look, you got to get the hell out of here. Go stay at the Howard Johnson's, because Stossel's threatening to press charges. The cops might be looking for you. Just get out of here. Don't even shower. Just grab your things and go to the hotel. And Vince tells him later on, according to Schultz, he says, oh, you did great. Don't worry about it. You did great. You did a great job. He was very happy with the way things went down. They say that McMahon told Schultz he was going to send him to Japan until the heat died down from the Stossel stuff. And the first thing that they want him to do over there, and it's not made clear if this was a Vince McMahon idea or if this came directly from Inoki, clearly there was a working relationship there at the time. Was this a case where they were in cahoots and Vince told Inoki, hey, I want you to make sure you have him do the same thing where, you know, he beats up a reporter? I don't know whose idea it was. All I know is that it was Vince McMahon's idea to send him over to Japan. And the first thing they wanted him to do over there was to basically reenact the whole situation with John Stossel, because everybody in Japan knew about it. Schultz was coming in. He was like a crazy man. They were going to, you know, book him as this unpredictable kind of guy who might go off and, you know, he beats up reporters and stuff. And Schultz said, well, I'll do it. You know, I want it in writing that it's part of the show. I want it, you know, I want there to be some kind of proof or evidence or whatever, if I'm going to do this, that it's just, it's all part of, you know, some greater plan here. And I'm not just doing this on my own. And they did the same thing. You know, they had all the papers there, snap photos of him. He basically knocked a reporter down over there, and it was on all the newspapers over in Japan. Here's the part that I'm confused by. Schultz doesn't get fired until the middle of February, after the Mr. T incident, which I'm going to get to. But the only record I could find of David Schultz going to Japan around that time in 1985, or the earliest that I could see records of him having gone to Japan to wrestle there after the Stossel incident, is in March. You know, New Japan had its big fight series those first 3 weeks in the month of March, and Schultz is all over those shows, against Inoki, against a whole bunch of different people. So I assume that that's when they did the thing with the reporter, but it just doesn't make sense to me, because it would have been after he was already fired and well after the Stossel incident had already occurred. So if you look at it's easy to look up the records of the matches from that year. Schultz continued to wrestle on WWF shows throughout the month of January and into February here in the States. So it's not as if they, you know, the slap happened, oh, we got to rush you out of the country, you know, tomorrow or next week. It's not like they rushed him out of the country because, oh, there's so much heat on you. The 2020 piece didn't air until late February. So maybe that's what he was referring to, but if he was fired by then, I don't know. I'm still confused about that timeline, but anyway. Stossel says that he was complaining at the time. He had ringing in his ears. Loud noises from outside would hurt his ears. Even the sounds of his baby crying hurt his ears. He wanted to teach WWE a lesson, and so he filed suit against them. But first, Schultz is called to Vince McMahon's office. He says Vince wants him to sign a piece of paper swearing that he hit Stossel on his own. The company had nothing to do with it. It was all his idea. This was David Schultz's responsibility, and you should sue him and not us. That's basically what Vince McMahon wanted out of this. It was his own doing. Schultz said, no, I'm not going to sign that because it wasn't my idea. It was your idea. You told me to do it. He says, I'll sign a paper if you want me to that I did what you told me to do. But I'm not going to sign that because Schultz wasn't named in the suit. WWE was. Now, none of us were there. And we've never heard Vince McMahon's side of things. And all these different stories, it's worth noting, Vince McMahon might have his own side of the story. I'm not even sure he would remember at this point. That's why, you know, I've said before, it would be fascinating to read a Vince McMahon book, and I would believe absolutely none of it. Because would you really honestly believe that he would be completely 100% honest in a book, you know, about his life? If he would tell the truth, I think it would make for a fascinating story. So we've never heard Vince McMahon address this. We've never heard him talk about it. I would love for him to go back and do one of the Broken Skull sessions and do another interview with Steve Austin and let Austin come, you know, ask some of these questions. They probably would cut it. They probably wouldn't even air it on the network. But I'd love to just get him, you know, seated one day and ask him some of these questions and see. He probably wouldn't say anything about it, but just ask the questions, see what his perspective and what his memory is of the situation. So I say that, though, because we don't know his side of the story. But Schultz comes across as credible to me on the idea that he was told by Vince McMahon what to do. Now, I don't necessarily think Vince McMahon was telling him to beat the guy up. I don't believe that he was like, oh, David, I want you to go out there and assault this man. I think he told him to blast him. He's probably talking verbally. I want you to stay in character. Blast him. Tear his ass up. I hear that and I think to myself, all right, he's probably wanting him to just, he was a good talker, so go out there and blast him in that way. That's what I think he probably meant, but I don't know that he was all, you know, all that upset when he did smack Stossel, knocked him on his ass. He probably didn't cry over it, but the idea that Vince McMahon would tell one of his wrestlers to assault a news reporter on camera, right there in the hallway backstage at Madison Square Garden. I don't know. To me, it just doesn't make that much sense unless he was looking for a reason to get rid of the guy, which I suppose is possible. Maybe he was looking for a reason to get rid of David Schultz for whatever the reason was. You know, we don't know. Unless Vince gives his side of the story, we just don't know. The stuff with the reporter in Japan, Schultz has said that he thinks the whole thing, looking back at it now, was a setup. Because later on in the depositions, the lawyers brought that incident up in Japan, trying to establish some sort of pattern. Well, look, see, this guy has a pattern of behavior now where he's going around and he's physically assaulting reporters. They tried to paint him as this violent, out-of-control guy who went around beating up reporters. You know, is there credibility to his belief that he was set up? Well, I mean, just look at the situation. Vince McMahon, it's his idea to send him over to Japan. We're going to send you to Japan. Oh, there's too much heat on you right now. It's for your own good. We're going to send you over to Japan. And the first thing they want him to do there is slap another reporter? I'm just saying, it makes you wonder. So they tried to shift the blame entirely onto Schultz, which, look, he did physically assault the guy. He wasn't defending himself. He did strike the man not once, but twice. That is a fact. It comes down to what he was told. Did Vince McMahon set him up for that, or did he really go out and do that on his own? Stossel ended up with a $280,000 judgment out of it. He said he hung on to his pain, but it did gradually go away when I got paid. He said this with the smuggiest of smug looks on his face. My pain went away when I got paid. Yeah, I'll bet it did. I'll bet. So WrestleMania 1 is coming up, right? In March of 85, Schultz has no visible spot on the card. They're bringing in Mr. T. They're paying him all this money, more than even some of the wrestlers are making. Maybe all but Hogan. And Schultz admits that, yeah, it bothered him. I believe the date, and I could be off on this, I think the date that this incident went down and he got fired was February 11, 1985. WWE is running a show in Los Angeles. Mr. T is there as a guest. Schultz claims that he was backstage chatting with Mr. T in the hallway, getting along just fine. I think he said, even in his book, he included a photo of the two of them hanging out backstage together. So if anybody has Dr. D's book and can confirm this, let me know. Chief J. Strongbow was the agent that night. He saw Schultz with T. He goes over to Schultz after and he says, look, if you bother him tonight, I'm going to have to fire you. And Schultz says, well, then I guess you're going to have to fire me. And Strongbow says, well, then, okay, you're fired. So later that night, Schultz, who I guess is still there, he makes his way down to ringside, where Mr. T is sitting in the front row, not to cause a scene, he says. He didn't go down there to cause a scene or beat him up or anything like that. He says that T was sitting with a good friend of his, Toru Tanaka. He just wanted to go down there and say hello to Tanaka. And Strongbow had seen Schultz going out there. He alerted the cops because he was worried about what Schultz might do. So the cops, like 10 or 15 cops, they come down there. They hogtie this guy. They put guns to his head, according to Schultz. There was one gun put to his head on the left side, one gun put to his head on the right side. They literally carried him all the way to the back. They threw him out the back door of the building, and they told him not to come back. Now, they played audio here on the episode from Hulk Hogan's appearance on Stone Cold's podcast, where Hogan claims Schultz got fired because he bitch-slapped Mr. T that night. He never bitch-slapped Mr. T, but he did get fired. It's hard to believe, you know, Schultz was not even 30 years old when the Stossel thing happened. And his career was all but over a couple of months after that. Hogan has claimed, I know, three of the most dangerous words in the English language. Hogan has claimed. Always be a little skeptical when you hear those three words. Hogan has claimed that that Schultz is the one who came up with the idea for the first WrestleMania main event. And the original idea would have had David Schultz tagging with Roddy Piper to take on Hulk Hogan and Mr. T. But then the incident happened in L.A., and he was gone right after that, and so Paul Orndorff got the spot instead. I could see this one being true. When Piper came to the WWF in 1984, he came in as a manager. I think he was injured, I think. He was still hurt from the dog collar match with Greg Valentine. He, like, busted his eardrum or something, so he was managing. He was not wrestling when he initially came in. And who were the two men that Piper managed? Paul Orndorff? And Dr. D. So the Dr. D connection to Piper was already there. Just imagine a Roddy Piper, Dr. D team in that first WrestleMania main event. But, I don't know. I was curious. So I went and I looked up the people that David Schultz was wrestling after the Stossel incident. I was just curious what they had him doing. Was he in main events? Was he winning? Was he losing? So I looked up his record of matches in January and February of 86, and even a little before that. And he was jobbing out to guys left and right. He wasn't losing every single match, but he was doing a lot of jobs. He was jobbing to guys like Tony Atlas, David Sammartino, who was hardly booked as some kind of big star, Blackjack Mulligan, Ivan Putski. I mean, it just seems odd to me that he would be losing all of these matches and booked so far down the card, second, third, fourth match from the top, or from the bottom, I should say. If the thought was that this is the guy you were building to tag with Roddy Piper in the very first WrestleMania main event against Hulk Hogan and Mr. T, it just seems very unlikely to me that they had that in mind. Maybe they told him that, but you just look at some of the matches that he was in, it certainly didn't look like he was being booked that way. You know, if anything, it kind of feels like maybe he already had one foot out the door, he just didn't know it. Schultz has also claimed that he either came up with the WrestleMania name as a playoff of Hulkamania, or that he had somehow deserved partial credit for it or something. That would fly in the face of the story that Howard Finkel had told, that he was the one who came up with the name for WrestleMania based off the whole Beatlemania craze from many years earlier when the Beatles came over to the States. You know, when Vince McMahon and his people started discussing, they had meetings in the summer of 84, they started having meetings to determine what would we call this event, this big super show that we want to do. They had meetings to discuss possible names for it. He wanted to go with the name The Colossal Tussle. That was the name that either Vince or somebody in his inner circle had recommended. I think it was Vince. The Colossal Tussle, we're going to call this big super show, which is a terrible name. And I think it was George Scott, as the story goes, George Scott was, you know, part of his inner circle. And he had claimed that he talked Vince McMahon out of it. Whoever it was, give that person a medal, because thankfully they did not go with that name. He was talked out of it. They wound up going with Finkel's suggestion instead, which was WrestleMania. Now, they did have a show called The Colossal Jostle in 85 at Madison Square Garden, but it wasn't in March of 85. It was later on in the year. That had a big Andre the Giant against King Kong Bundy match, the one where Bundy took that hard bump out of the ring to the floor, damn near killed himself, right on the concrete. That was called The Colossal Jostle. So I can believe that story that they had this Colossal Tussle name and he got talked out of it, but then he ended up getting some variation of it the following year anyway. I believe a lot of what I heard from Dr. D on this show. He does come across to me as being very credible, but if he's claiming elsewhere in other interviews over the years that the WrestleMania name was his idea, and you ask me, who do I believe, David Schultz or Howard Finkel? I'm siding with the Fink. So they did get into his later career as a bounty hunter. Basically, when he was excommunicated from wrestling, he had to go find work. It was suggested to him that perhaps this might be a good fit for you. And he took to it like a duck to water, and he talked about his most memorable case as a bounty hunter. He told the story of a guy who had kidnapped two teenage girls, kept them, you know, chained to a toilet or something. And he found the guy in a strip club in Puerto Rico and, you know, basically brought him to justice. There was another interview that Schultz did where he mentioned one trick, which I thought was fascinating. One trick that he used in or has used over the years in trying to apprehend people, trying to apprehend suspects, is rigging someone's car. He's done this a few times where he'll rig their car with cayenne pepper. So that when they start the engine up, when they go to start the car, the pepper would fly everywhere. And it would be so bad they couldn't breathe. They would have no choice but to get out of the car. And that's when Schultz would swoop in and he'd be there waiting to grab him and bring him in. So I've heard him talk about that before. Only a few years after the first WrestleMania and all of the stuff, keeping kayfabe, it's so important, the business, you know, Vince McMahon at the Garden that night, we got this reporter who's looking to make a joke of our business, and he's going to just ruin kayfabe, go out there and, you know, do what you got to do. After all of that, they talk about how it was only a few years later that Vince McMahon, actually it was Vince and Linda McMahon, publicly acknowledged that what they do is entertainment. They did this as a way to avoid paying certain taxes and fees to the various state athletic commissions and to try to get the business deregulated in different states because they felt that they were taking too much money, you know, from the gate and everything else. Why should they be getting all this money? We should be classified like the Ice Capades and some of these other things, not like football and boxing and baseball and things of that nature. So they showed footage here in this episode of the press conference years later. This was in March of 1997 in New Jersey, the press conference where they deregulated professional wrestling to bring wrestling back to the state. And they had the Undertaker standing next to the governor, Christine Todd Whitman. I remember that. I remember them showing that on TV because even on WWE television, they show, you know, highlights of the press conference. And you've got the Undertaker standing over her shoulder. And you've got Whitman saying, with the help of the Undertaker, I will now put this tax to rest and may it rest in peace. Yeah, there were no televised WWF shows in the state of New Jersey after 1990 until they did that in 97. And then lo and behold, SummerSlam came to New Jersey later on that same year. But the reason they didn't run Jersey for 7 or 8 years, whatever it was, for TV. They didn't run New Jersey for TV, maybe they did for live events, was because they would have to pay this $100,000, what they called a media tax. Every time they ran a TV event in the state, they would be charged $100,000 for this stupid media tax. You know what? I could see why they wouldn't want to run TV in the state. So anyway, that's why that happened. Cornette believes that there was only one of two ways for Schultz's career to go, you know, if were it not for the John Stossel incident. He says most likely there would have been some other kind of blow up between him and Vince McMahon when Vince was taking the product in a more cartoonish direction. That probably would have been the end of him anyway. Schultz said that he's willing to sit down now today with John Stossel and kind of straighten things out. He promises not to hurt him. And Stossel's parting message for David Schultz at the end of this episode, in response to the question of what would you say to David Schultz right now if you had the chance? Stossel's parting message? Fuck you, David. It's good to see he's gotten over it. Jim Cornette went on Twitter after the episode aired. He saw people tagging John Stossel in tweets, and I guess he didn't realize that John Stossel was on Twitter. So Cornette said, I just realized since there was no Twitter in 1985, I had no way of telling at John Stossel what I thought of him, but now I can. You got what you deserved, you whiny little bitch. I'm sorry you got a settlement out of it, but if anybody ever fit the description of plaintiff, it's you. This Tuesday is the Herb Abrams episode of Dark Side of the Ring titled Cocaine and Cowboy Boots, the Herb Abrams story. One man's fanatical attempt to build a wrestling empire to rival Vince McMahon's goes tragically haywire as his ego and cocaine addiction kills his dream and him along with it. I think this is going to be a very wild episode. I'm looking forward to this one. May 12 is the Road Warrior story, and then the series ends on May 19th with the Owen Hart story. It's time for this week's RSPW Rewind. This week we're going back in time to the year 1998, in full swing of the Attitude Era. It's been a few weeks. I have missed doing this, so I hope you'll take a stroll on back in time with me. We begin with a post by Greg Dillard, who calls himself the Opened Package for some reason. Open package of what? Nuts? Cheese? Condoms? He doesn't say. From September 4th, 1998, just days after SummerSlam Highway to Hell, a post titled The Opened Package Rant about the WWF. First of all, this is my first post here on RSPW, and I'm glad to be here. Aw, oh, that's cute. He hasn't been corrupted yet. Give it time. Lately, it's been unbelievably easy to bash WCW for a lot of its booking, events, and overall performance. Been like shooting fish in a barrel. Bashing the WWF, though, sure, there are some WCW marks out there, but most critics are decidedly pro-WWF, and with good reason. You definitely can't argue with the recent success, or can you? Whether you choose to believe it or not, there is a flaw in the current direction of the WWF. Vince and his gang have taken the step of eliminating the traditional face-heel alignment of most wrestlers, instead crafting a stable of tweeners that normally get face heat from the crowd. This fact, combined with Steve Austin wearing the gold, present Vince with a complicated scenario in booking future angles and opponents at the top of his federation. Evidence of this is the current Austin Undertaker feud. This feud took nearly 6 months to craft. Mainly, when it first began, Undertaker was the number two face in the company. Vince had to create a web of storylines surrounding the angle to keep the Undertaker babyface, yet get some heel heat. The supporting characters of Mankind and Kane are the ones that really made this happen. Now, if you're questioning my logic, let me ask you, who's next for Steve Austin? Does he battle Kane again? A rematch with The Undertaker? Or could Vince be worried that the product is becoming stale? I'd put money on it that he is. Let's see. You could throw The Rock against Austin. But does anybody seriously believe that my Villa is ready for a main event run? Oh, the open package. Apparently he allowed his brain to be rotted out. Poor guy. How about Triple H? Well, the ladder match was a good step, but I think Helmsley is much better as the number two guy than the guy. Well, he got that right. I take back what I said about the open package. See, even he understands that Triple H is not the guy. He's the guy that works with the guy. And there's nothing wrong with that. Says, this is exactly my point. Vince is building his organization with a very shaky foundation. Given the current roster, champion, and depth, detailed precision booking is necessary to carry out a simple run for the gold, which really should be the easiest angle to craft in the first place. Too bad Vader has been jobbed to death. He could be the man, really play heel to Austin. Right now, though, he's a joke to most fans after losing to Mark Henry. Regardless, Vince needs to take a close look at where the organization is going in the short run, or risk a WCW-type creative decline. Well, had the Brawl for All gone the way that they wanted it to, they would have had Dr. Death lined up to challenge Austin. Instead, we got The Rock, who, according to the open package, wasn't ready for a main event run. Mike responded, the only reply to this post, "I got a satellite a few months ago and reconnected to the WWF and WCW. I missed all of the 90s action, and even some late 80s. That said, I'm having a hard time dealing with either federation. Neither has made me think, even for an instant, of buying a pay-per-view, and I'm about to stop watching altogether. My complaints are as follows." Well, this should be good. "While I like watching Steve Austin and believe him to be credible as champion, I cannot give such credit to his three main challengers. I'm sorry to you who think of Undertaker and Kane as deserving or able-bodied to be the champion. To me, these guys are clones of one another, and even Hogan, with too few moves and not very fast, was a good salesman when on the receiving end. Foley is much better, but the character changes he's gone through leave me confused. Who is he? And will we ever see a Dude Love Cactus Jack feud? A crazy man is champion? Not for me. Next, we have two brothers messing up each other's matches, and I realize that when we watch wrestling, there is a measure of reality that we forget about, but the guys in the ring see Doofus One and his brother Lame. I guess instead of Kane, he called him Lame. Coming down to give the almighty chokeslam. Why don't they run or put up a fight when they see them coming down to the ring? What I know now is that none of the WWF talent is able to stand up to Undertaker and Lame. Just let their butts get kicked, and Undertaker and Lame can't do the job on Austin, so we have a champion more indestructible than Goldberg. Now we are blessed with a triple threat match. Let's see. The brothers, each wanting to be the champion, keep pulling each other off of Austin until they turn on one another, go to the floor, dazed and stone cold, pins the other one. When has that script been used before? Bring in Rocky or Triple H or even Blackman, Ken Shamrock or Bart Gunn. They may not be as ready for prime time, but I am weary of the four-way battle going on right now, and say so with my remote control. Tennis, anyone? I'm getting the feeling that WCW, also very lame, is watching WWF for ideas. Maybe the sum total of decent talent available has probably always been under a dozen, but none of the current top guys really make me care, face or heel. And the plots? It's just not working. Where's the remote? Clicking off now. So Mike says no to the Attitude Era and NWO Era of WCW. I wonder if Mike would be happier with the PG Era or the stuff that we have today. I'm guessing Mike is not watching anyway, so it doesn't matter. On September 15th, 1998, Ripclaw was one of the first people to post about the arrival of a real man's man in the WWF. One Steven Regal. Steven Regal is a man's man, he says. He is going to be chopping down the competition in the WWF like a buzzsaw. Alicia Snow was devastated. She said, "This made me roll over on the floor and cry. This is a stupid gimmick that won't work. Why not just let him be Steve Regal, the annoying British heel? That's what he does best." Ice Arth, or maybe it's Ick Earth? I don't know. He says, "I agree. I liked Lord Steven Regal. What are they doing to him? Trying to replace Hacksaw Jim Duggan with Regal." Professor Rev 777. "Well, in my opinion, I think they'll keep playing these man's man promos, but then he'll still be a whiny heel when he wrestles. Then he'll expose the fact that Regal paid for those spots to make himself look tough. I think it would be funny anyway." Tom Hyatt proclaims, All I can say is the day he comes out in women's clothing is the day that I quit watching the WWF for good. Well, I hate to break the news to you, Tom Wyatt, but that's exactly what happened, I believe, just a few years later. I mean, didn't Regal dress up as a woman on TV once in like 01 or 02 or something? What, it was like the mid-2000s? Maybe it was the mid-2000s, maybe a few years later. I vaguely remember this. I may have blocked it from my memory. Somebody can help me out. And Vinny says, I hope they make Regal an old-fashioned British macho man. Anyone from the north of England will know what I mean, and he has to be a woman hater. I love that part. Is that like a northern England thing that I'm not aware of? Do people from northern England hate women? Or maybe they did in 1998. I need somebody from the north of England to hit me up and let me know if this is a thing or not, because that's terrible. Oh my goodness. The very next day, September 16th, Quentin Chester Elwood Koish. That's a mouthful. With a post titled, I personally thought that the Steven Regal Man's Man promo was hilarious. That's not a headline, that's a message. You gotta tighten that thing up when you put a headline together. Less is more, Quentin. Says, at first I was watching the tube thinking that it is some stupid TSN promo for an outdoor show or a promo for a lumberjacking tournament. Then I heard the WWF announcer voice and I became wide-eyed the whole time thinking that this was the worst gimmick ever. But then I started to find it comical and nearly fell off the couch, the couch, laughing. However, this gimmick has probably the highest propensity to go belly up. Some people aren't going to like it, some people aren't going to love it. I just hope they let Regal have the mic, because I remember his hilarious degradation of Americans in the early WCW days, and it was great. So let's see if he has what it takes to get away from that and have good mic skills for something else. Michael Price is having none of it. First, Eric ruins him. Now Vince buries him. Steven Regal is too good for the treatment that he has gotten from both WCW and the WWF. He is one of the top mat wrestlers in the business right now. Owen disagrees. He says, yeah, the way you bury somebody is by cutting an expensive promo for him and placing it prominently into your flagship show. Otherwise known as Golgo 13, says, that's his name. Otherwise known as Golgo 13, has this to say. He says he needs to join All Japan or New Japan. At least there his tremendous skills can flourish. See, so even 22 years ago, there were people hoping for a WWE talent to leave for New Japan. Jawa took issue with Michael Price's reply. He's quoting him. Says, first Eric ruins him, then Vince buries him. He had a promo on Raw. How is that being buried, you idiot? Says, Steven Regal is too good for the treatment he's gotten from WCW and WWF. Oh, do you mean the big money contract or the push on Monday Night Raw? Yeah, he's too good to be pushed and paid a lot of money. Says, he is one of the top wrestlers in the business right now, the top mat wrestlers. And Jawa says, that all by itself is not going to get him over. In spite of what you seem to think, moron, wrestling is not high art. It's rough around the edges, working man's theater, and gimmicks will always be part of it. You should stop watching wrestling if this isn't providing you what you're looking for. But then, how would you fill up all the time you use to spend whining on the internet? And I'm sure glad he's got you to fight his battles for him, loser. Michael Price responds. Sounds like he and Jawa have history together. Says, hey look, it's Jawa again. What are the odds that meaningless insults would come from you? You said that he had a promo on Raw. How is that being buried, you idiot? By forcing him into a stupid cartoon gimmick, that's how. Says, oh, do you mean the big money contract or the push on Raw? Yeah, he's too good to be pushed and paid a lot of money. Well, you can make a lot of money selling drugs on the street too. Why don't you go do that if money is all you care about? Says, Matt wrestling is not going to get him over. You might actually be... Okay, So then he says, you might actually be on point here when you say that, but your statements were lost when you start insulting me for no reason. Too bad you can't form any real sentences to actually defend your position. And then, of course, he had said, I'm sure glad he's got you to fight your battles for him, you loser. To which Michael Price says, well, there are the insults again. You might want to see a shrink to find out why you can't express yourself properly. Jawa had something to say about that, and even floated his own explanation for the man's man gimmick, which I had never heard before, and I think is very far-fetched. I believe he's reaching so hard he's like Stretch Armstrong on this. But you can chime in and let me know if you agree. Says the gimmick is that he's a real man, a tough guy, the polar opposite of his WCW gimmick. WWF wants to give the impression that WCW booked Regal with a silly, stereotypical gimmick, and now, in the WWF, we will be seeing the real Steven Regal. The lumberjack thing was a dig at Goldberg, whom he exposed and made look silly and fired from WCW because of it. That's his heat right now. He's the guy who cut Goldberg, the tallest tree in the forest, down to size. Explain the cartooniness? I'll give you a hint. Just because you want him to have a cartoony gimmick for the sole purpose of extending your complaining marathon, thereby filling in the void of boredom, does not mean that he actually does have a cartoony gimmick. He doesn't. And if you think he does, please explain why in detail. Yeah, again, I don't buy that explanation for a second. I think he's... it's like if you go to a museum or like an art gallery and you're looking at a painting on the wall and it's just a bunch of blotches and a bunch of colors and shapes. Somebody comes over and says to you, oh, it means it's about, you know, the fountain of youth, and it's about the meaning of life, and it's an existential crisis. Shut up. It's a bunch of shapes and a bunch of colors. It means something different to everybody. That's his explanation for it. I guarantee you that's not why WWF did the gimmick. Andre Mitchell agrees. Andre Mitchell says, you can't possibly believe that anybody outside this news group knows about any Regal Goldberg connection. Here, let me help you. Back away from the keyboard, take Vince McMahon's wee-wee out of your mouth, and turn off the computer and go outside. Go outside and ask another wrestling fan who does not read RSPW, and ask them if they know about a Goldberg versus Regal situation. Once you've discovered another world outside RSPW, you will gain the perspective of seeing wrestling for what it is. No, there isn't some underlying theme to Regal's gimmick. He's being repackaged, and who knows whether it's going to work or not. Take Double J as an example. He has changed his image twice since returning to the WWF. All the WWF is doing is trying to get the fans to care about him. That's all. Shadow says, does no one have a sense of humor? The whole Regal thing is a joke. It has nothing to do with Goldberg, and if it does, it's only an underlying subtext. The whole promo was purposely generic, over the top, and outdated, and obviously so. It blows my mind that some smarts sit around and gab for hours and hours about how dumb the marks are, and yet they can't decipher something so blatantly simple. I haven't seen one person on RSPW who actually has recognized the obvious sarcasm of Regal's gimmick. How can there be so much confusion? Were you mad when you thought the WWF was pushing the Briscoe Brothers Body Shop as a face stable? Right now, the pure babyface in wrestling is dead. Promoters have yet to tap into the prospect of pushing sickeningly generic traditional faces as actual heels, and the whole Regal thing is the start of it. Remember in late 1996, when Michaels had gotten to the point where only the female fans were cheering him and the guys were just annoyed by his persona, and McMahon tried to push him as a man's man to alter that? I dare say the reuse of that moniker is a direct poke at that failure, and that fans will be booing the hell out of that cheesy face McMahon is trying to push on us within weeks. And finally, way into the future, on March 25th, 2010, we have this gem from the original Bastard. Gimmick idea for a man named Bill Durr. He could be a man's man William Regal 2010. Could also rename himself Bob and appeal to Vince's new G-rated audience. Bill Durr. Or would it be Bill Durr? I'm not sure. But this has been your weekly reminder. Well, I mean, I don't have one this week, but the man's man gimmick was a Vince Russo idea that Regal hated. Regal also has no memory of that period, as he had a huge drug problem at the time. And even though it only lasted about 5 or 6 weeks, he once said that it totally overshadowed everything else that he has ever done in his career. You can email me your questions, thesolomonster@gmail.com, for mailbag questions that could be used either on the show, on a video mailbag on YouTube. I just got two really quick things here, and then we'll wrap up, and I'll try to get to more questions next week, or use them on YouTube. But Rob from the Bronx had followed up on my Dark Side of the Ring review on Dino Bravo. He said, I met the Honky Tonk Men at the Wrestling Universe a few days after Dusty Rhodes passed away. I asked him what he thought about Dusty, and he didn't mince words. He said every time Dusty moved his mouth, he was lying. He said when Dusty was leaving the WWF to go back down south, he told Honky that he, Coco Beware, and Dino Bravo were all going to be brought into WCW. Obviously, that didn't happen, but this is what the Honky Tonk Man claims. Well, it's the Honky Tonk Man, so, you know, you can never really be sure. But I could see Dusty saying that to be nice, and then just not following through. But why Honky Tonk Man, Coco Beware, and Dino Bravo? What a weird trio. Unless he just told everybody, hey, you're going to get a call to come to WCW. That's a very odd trio. But there it is. According to the Honky Tonk Man, Dino Bravo was going to get a call to come to WCW, and that call just never came. And a Chase from Rapid City, South Dakota. Who do you think has become the brightest star in AEW? Who has benefited the most from AEW forming? I mean, a lot of people have benefited from AEW forming. Jim Ross, it's given him a second lease on life as a play-by-play guy. A big company to work for on a live major, you know, cable platform. Tony Schiavone has had this resurgence in his announcing career as well. And he wears a lot of hats in AEW. He doesn't just do announcing. He helps a lot of people behind the scenes. He, you know, does a lot of social media stuff. So for Tony, it's like he's having this new career 20 years after WCW died. So I could go down the list and talk about who has benefited from AEW being formed. I think the whole wrestling business has benefited because it's another big company that people can go work for and make real money. That's a good thing for everybody. It's a great thing for Cody and the Bucks and Omega, who all have those EVP titles. Cody is rightfully the biggest star in the company. I mean, just even just the reactions he gets when he comes out, that's how he's positioned because he is. He's the biggest star in the company. But who's the brightest star? The brightest kind of shining star in AEW? When I think of some of the newer guys, the younger guys, I would say it comes down to three names who I think have really shined and have the potential to go on to become really big names in AEW, and who knows, one day maybe even somewhere else. Darby Allin, Sammy Guevara, and MJF. And MJF was already a star on the rise in MLW. But MLW doesn't have the same kind of reach and the same kind of exposure that AEW has given him. So they've taken that MJF character that was already, you know, built and already, you know, playing itself out on television in on a smaller scale, and they've blown it up. And MJF, maybe out of all of them, has the greatest potential to really go on to become a big, big star. But those are the three guys that really stand out. Sammy Guevara has impressed me. I really have enjoyed, you know, his contributions and his matches, the matches with Darby, and then Darby. I mean, Darby is one of the most over guys that they have in the whole company. I mean, so is Orange Cassidy. Orange Cassidy is another one you could put on the list. But I think in terms of brightest stars, yeah, those are the three that I think of. Darby, Sammy, and MJF. Again, keep emailing me your questions. I have a few more. I'm going to hold on to these. TheSolomonster@gmail.com is where you can send that to. I'll try to get to as many of them as I can. I feel like I'm always backlogged and playing catch-up on emails, but I shall do my best. I am going to have my Money in the Bank predictions. I don't know if I'm going to go live like I did for the WrestleMania ones or just upload them, but that's something to watch for later in the week, probably Thursday or Friday. We'll get those up before the pay-per-view on Sunday. Of course, after the pay-per-view next Sunday, and I'll remind everybody again next week, but I'll be going live on YouTube, full Money in the Bank recap. Don't forget, you could also see me, if you're interested, on PWR, Pro Wrestling Report, prime time, live on Fight TV, every Monday night at 7 Eastern. It's an hour before Monday Night Raw. I'll be joining Damian Nelson, David Hero, and the rest of the crew. So that next appearance is coming up tomorrow, May 4th. May the 4th be with you. Be well, stay safe, and I'll see you guys back here for episode 651 next Sunday, and of course, the Dynamite stream live on YouTube on Wednesday. Until then, take care, guys.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
Orton went for the punt kick. Edge caught him with a spear. And so they have to sell, and they're moaning. I mean, if you were to just, like, if you were a blind person, all you could do is hear what was going on. All you would hear are the wrestlers going,
oh, my God.
Maybe he had Taco Bell for lunch, the way these guys were moaning out there. That'll be a drop.
The Sala Monster sounds off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesalamonster for sound off extras and more. And follow the Sala Monster on Twitter at Sala Monster.
Sala Monster.
Put that cigarette out.
Sala Monster sounds off.